just have an open discussion.
AFF there's no meeting real agenda. On December 8th, 2009.
There's a signing and sheet to go around. And I guess we just go ahead and start with introductions. I'm Bernard Clatt. I work for the Corps in the Portland District here. I'm the Fish and Wildlife Program Manager. I've kind of taken the lead on this effort to deal with the plans for the AFF, the Adult Fish Facility at Bonneville, and our future needs. And I fund that facility. And we started back in August. We had a meeting. Several of you were there, several were not, but I'll just go ahead and jump right into the review of this thing. Well, actually, no, let's do introductions first. I'm sorry. Tammy Mackey.
I'm Tammy Mackey, Burns assistant.
Oh, thanks.
Hi, Rishi Sharma. I'm with the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. I'm also the chair of the Chinook Technical Committee for the Pacific Salmon Commission, Southern U.S. chair of that.
And I'm Stuart Ellis. I'm with Intertribe also, and I'm on the TAC, and I'm chair of it.
My name is Scott Brandt. I'm with the Shoshone-Bannock Tribes in Idaho, harvest biologist. I'm also on TAC, and actually the FPAC, which I missed today.
I'm Robin Helke, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, Captain of Harvest Management.
Hello.
Hello.
This is Chris Caudill at the University of Idaho.
Hey, Chris. We're going around the room right now doing introductions, and we'll get right back to you, okay?
No problem.
John Whitaker, Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission.
I'm David Clugson with the Florida Division.
Chris Grant with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Columbia River Management.
Jeff Fryer, Cricket.
Alan Byrne, Idaho Fish and Game, member of TAC.
Great. On the phone, I know we have John Rearsick from the Bonneville Project Fisheries Office, and it sounds like Chris Caudill, you called in from University of Idaho. Anybody else on the phone?
I'm on the phone. John Hess from Cryptic out in the genetics lab in Hagerman, Idaho.
Thanks for calling in, John. And?
Dan Routing, Washington Fish and Wildlife.
And Dan Routing, Washington Fish and Wildlife. Well, okay, well, thanks for all coming. It's hopefully we'll be here for, we got the room till 4 o'clock, and I don't know what's going to occur between now and then, but hopefully we'll make some progress on basically what the long-term intent for the adult fish facility is at the Bonneville Dam. So I'm going to go over a quick review of some of the meetings we've had in the past 2 years. Back in August of 2008, Rock Peters from our policy office and Rob Lothrop decided that we needed to sit down and talk about some of these issues. We met out at Bonneville at the auditorium, and there was a lot of concerns from NOAA Fisheries, which Gary will be coming down in a minute, hopefully, to join us about the long-term use of the facility and the short-term. But from this meeting, you know, CRITFIC uses the AFF for a variety of purposes, implementing commitments in the Pacific Salmon Treaty and the USV Oregon and river management responsibilities, including the length and stock composition used for run reconstruction. Some of the new needs coming at that time was the MOA or the Fish Accords that was a 10-year commitment, mostly with BPA projects, but there was going to be definitely forecasted an increased need for sampling at the AFF. So with that, one of the concerns that National Marine Fisheries Service had was, you know, what's the long-term plan? There's issues with handling. The facility never was designed for this kind of use. When we get to a certain temperature, then we have issues. And we discussed for about 2 hours and kind of summed it up with there's some needs here. CRITFIC committed to looking at other ways of getting some information they needed for the harvest. Explore using fish count windows to reduce the handling of fish. looked at increased juvenile tagging, a better handling of numbers of fish needed, and why. NOAA agreed to some different time and use of the picket leads to 4 days a week at the time, and then that winter we changed the configuration to the picket leads to a vertical, and that actually led to the next meeting, which was June 25th of 2009. We kind of reviewed what happened from that, basically that year. And in 2009, we looked at the, we evaluated the new picket leads and how they're working. There were some issues that was brought to the table about maybe extending the use of getting the sample, and the result of that discussion ended up maybe shifting your sampling time. What did we shift to, 6 in the morning? Hours?
We shifted to later, and then within like a week, it shifted back again.
Right. But the new configuration seemed to work for both needs, as not impacting the run as much, and you still getting your samples.
I would disagree about that.
Really? Well, we'll have that discussion. Sure. I'm just laying it all out, and then we can have an open discussion. Some of the issues that Gary wanted to talk about was what's the current use and need, what happens when 1% of the run wasn't sampled, does the harvest fall apart, future use modifications, which led into another meeting, which was what is the short-term and the long-term modifications that can be done to the facility. Of course, money is always going to be a big issue. The Corps is kind of getting to the point where they're about to step away from the facility. I got a new roof installed on the facility, and it's been like, you know, a miracle to get that, and that thing has been leaking for years. So to get some more money to improve it is going to be a challenge on my end, and I'm sure on everybody else's end. But inside the facility, what can be done? The only thing that we've done so far is the picket lead configuration. I just want to give some of the small issues and then the long-term issues, and then we're just going to open it up for discussion. So this group met, consisted of a subgroup from here and some other people from the other agencies. Some of the small things are real easy, like rubber gaskets here and there. I'm not going to get into the detail, but the long-term is CritFic requested a facility at the count windows. Due to the space limitations, it'd be difficult to get a handling facility in the fish viewing window area of the visitor center. That was one thing. NOAA Fisheries suggested starting all over with a new building. They'd like to see reduced reliance on the AFF. We assembled a task force to look at the future need for sorting, handling, proper sizing tanks, and providing enough water. Another thing we want to do is meet with youth people today, and then also maybe a group working on basin-wide sampling and tagging, and it was suggested that the AFF team at the subgroup that we had established start looking at that, see if efforts could be coordinated to, when it comes to tagging fish by CritFic for harvest management, you know, can we use pit tags, or what other kind of tag analysis can we do? What's the status? And that basically brought us to here, where we wanted to meet with the harvest tech and talk about some of these concerns, what your intent is, are there plans to get away from less handling or pit tags, where are we at? I'll open it up right now.
There's a few people that joined us on the phone now.
Oh, some more people on the phone. Anybody join us on the phone? I didn't.
I heard the beeping.
All right.
Well, maybe I could go first from a couple of the key harvest management things that we need that are based on data collected at Bonneville. For spring and summer Chinook, we rely on the scale data to determine the age composition, well, actually for sockeye as well. So spring, summer, chinook, and sockeye. We are enormously reliant on scale data collected at Bonneville as the main data that we have on the age composition of the upriver spring and Snake River spring, summer, chinook run that are managed between the first of the year and June 15th. And then also for the Upper Columbia summer chinook run, which is managed between June 16 and July 30th. And then the sockeye run that occurs in June and July. And so those scale data from the AFF we've been reliant on the Bonneville sampling for those data since the Corbett test fishery ended in the before Powerhouse 2 was built. And so basically for the entire life of the AFF, we've been reliant on scale data for the age composition of the run there. And we anticipate that that need will go on forever, that we have to get scales from a good portion of the run to we use that scale data as one of the primary aspects of our spring and summer chinook and sockeye forecasts. We are currently less reliant on those data for fall chinook because we have better coated wire tagging for fall chinook, and we're doing the run reconstruction more based on coated wire tag recoveries. And then plus with the different races of fall chinook, we're doing different things with the Thule type chinook as opposed to the Bright type chinook. Then the other big thing that we need from the USV Oregon harvest perspective are steelhead data. Currently under the new 10-year management agreement, which is now in its second year, we are the main stem harvests are managed on a total harvest rate of B-index steelhead, which are steelhead greater than 78 centimeters. And the run size is the Bonneville Dam run size for B steelhead. So we have to be able to figure out a way to estimate the number of these larger size steelhead at Bonneville Dam. And it turns out it's a complicated task. We used to try and manage for the wild bee component of it. And there was so much uncertainty in the data concerning the wild bee run that we finally resolved that we just simply didn't have the tools to do that. And we were thinking that we had enough data to do it with the total bee run. But this year has even kind of brought that into question, whether we're able to do that successfully. The summer steelhead run the shape of the run timing curve has probably changed some over the past 30 or 40 years. It used to maybe more have two peaks where there was kind of an early peak and a later peak, and in ancient history we used to try and manage for an early component of steelhead and a later component of steelhead. Now the peaks are much more muddled, but we've got A-run steelhead, which are supposedly the smaller run steelhead returning to the Snake Basin in the Salmon and the Oregon tributaries. And then we've got A-run type fish that return to everywhere else in the basin. It generally tends to reach peak counts at Bonneville in August. And the counts stay fairly strong through September, But the B-type fish, these larger fish, they start a little later, so they're just starting to pick up in August, and they tend to peak in September, and kind of in the back half of that. And then they both, by the end of September, the counts are dropping off, and both runs are winding down, and they're pretty much done by the end of October. But because of that differential run timing, it's sampling steelhead to get enough of these B-type fish to get any certainty about the run has always proved kind of problematic, and we've always struggled with the estimates. And this year is a case in point, and Alan may want to go into this a little bit. We also have sampling at Lower Granite, which is done at a much higher sample rate than Bonneville. They're sampling, depending in the fall season, one of the main objectives they're doing is they're collecting fall chinook broodstock for the snicker or fall chinook hatchery programs, and as a result they're handling anywhere between 10% and 20% of the run depending on the year. And so they're, by doing that, they're catching, you know, 10% to 20% of the fall chinook and 10% to 20% of the steelhead. It's a very large harvest rate. It's averaged probably in the 12% to 14% range, and so they get a real good sample of steelhead there. And they're doing a similar exercise of collecting length data and scale data and things on these steelhead. And so we felt that at Lower Granite, they've probably got a much more precise estimate of the runs there, just because of the sample rate. And they came up with a B steelhead run size for this fall. And granted, there'll be a few more B steelhead that will come in the spring, but not many of them. That basically, what was it, Alan, in the 10?
It's about just a little bit under 21,000.
And whereas we were estimating a run in the 43,000 range at Bonneville this year, and for B steelhead. And as a result of that, we set a harvest rate limit for the non-treaty harvest rates set at a 2% level, but the tribal harvest rate fluctuates, and the tribal harvest rate at run sizes that are up that high goes up to 20%, whereas if it were below
35,000,
it drops to 15%, and it's a significant number of fish. And Alan has pointed out that it may entirely be possible that we, because of this uncertainty in the calculations, you know, based on the limited data on B steelhead we have, that we may have dramatically overshot the B steelhead run size at Bonneville. We don't have any way in hindsight to prove this one way or the other, because we can't go back and resample the run to find out how many there were. So we probably... we haven't done our steelhead run reconstruction yet, so we haven't really talked about what we're going to do with our estimate of the run size this year. I suspect it's probably going to be have to end up remaining the same, just because we won't have the information to reliably change it. But what that will do is it'll make this this big thing that'll stand out, that that, you know, that we had this huge run of B steelhead at Bonneville. And we caught a bunch of fish in Zone 6 in the tribal fishery, based on that, about 18% of that 43,000. And then it'll show up that there was, you know, on paper, there will have been this huge loss of B steelhead somewhere in the hydro system. And everybody will stand around scratching their heads going, what happened to these fish? And we're going to go, I don't know. It's like, you know, did these fish ever exist at all? And we're going to go, I don't know. And yet we'll be fairly confident that some 20,000 of them reached Lower Granite this fall, plus, you know, there might be another 1,000 of them that will go by in the spring. And
the number we're confident in is the number at Bonneville. I mean, at Granite, because we have a very good sampling program there. They sample throughout the run, spring and summer, so there's very few fish coming over. In fact, the adult ladder there will be dewatered here probably next week. And then they'll resume the sampling again in March. But about 21,000 have come over. Now, there's some that were caught in the fishery. There are some that probably, there are some big steelhead that go other than the Snake River. And then there's still some downriver that will come over in the spring. Typically, 10 to 15% will come over in, you know, late March, April, early May. If you add that, you're still probably less than 25,000 total bees have come over. What's even more frightening from our perspective is that that's the total hatchery wild. We only estimate just barely 44,000 wild bees have come over Granite. So Stuart pointed out, the question is this, did we just somewhere, are we missing a lot of fish or a lot of fish going elsewhere? Did 45,000 really come over Bonneville, or did only, you know, 33,000 come over Bonneville?
And we
can't really answer that right now.
Given the sample rates and the number of bee-sized fish that we actually saw at, you know, in the sampling at Bonneville, relative to this entire run, which was nearly one of the largest, and second largest summer steelhead run ever, few bee-sized fish that we saw at Bonneville relative to the 600,000 almost that passed Bonneville, depending on how you deal with the data, whether you pool the data by weeks or by months or there's a number of ways that you can do this, you can come up with pretty much any range of run sizes that you want. And the data that we're getting for those bee fish just don't seem to be that significant.
I guess, Stuart, I would just also add that 2009 is not unique, just in a sense that getting our hands on enough fish to get a comfortable run size of steelhead. You know, certainly, I think we had the same issues. Same type of issues and just
it's
2008.
The scale of it may be dramatic just because of the overall size of the run this year, but the problem has been a recurring problem for steelhead.
Yes, and I think there's the other thing that why it's a problem is that we almost have to have a real time estimate because you have to manage your fisheries. If all we had to do is figure out how many steelhead came over Granite Dam at the end of the year, we could probably pool it by two or three periods, but the fishermen need to know how many bee steelhead are at Granite so they can put their nets in the water.
Or we need some indication
or you can go sport fishing, and so they need to have a number, so the sampling has to occur relatively real time.
Yeah.
So if I may jump in a little bit, the other thing that's going on is that as part of the biop, one of the reasonable prudent alternatives is to really deal with this bee run steelhead issue. And so it's a big priority, just not for TAC, but it's a big priority for everything in the Columbia Hydro system. It's been identified as being problematic recently because of low sample rates and missed days. So I can tell you that I was sampling out there in the late 90s, early 2000s, when we had less restrictions about sampling, the estimates were more precise. I don't know if they met everyone's needs, but they were more precise. So it's not just a TAC issue, it's not just, it's just not just a TAC issue. It's a pretty big issue for salmon and steelhead in the Columbia Basin.
And not just harvest.
It's just not harvest, yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The whole recovery strategy for bee steelhead, you know, hinges on how many we've got returning. And if, we can tell kind of, at Granite, we can tell how many are there. We have trouble figuring out how many of these steelhead spawn in Idaho because they spawn in hard to get to places, so they're hard to count when they spawn. So we've got a number at Granite, but our estimates of productivity on Snake River steelhead in general are, we got to have a good understanding of how many fish are coming back, because if the steelhead are returning to, really downstream of Bonneville, we've got some summer mainstem sport fishing for steelhead. It's not a huge amount. We've got some tribal or non-tribal commercial impacts in the early fall, but it's probably not a huge amount. And so really the steelhead getting to Bonneville are probably a pretty good representation of how many fish came back from the ocean. At least it's a pretty strong index of that.
Yeah.
And if we had 43,000-45,000 B steelhead this year, those fish were pretty productive. If we only had 30,000 of them, they weren't nearly as productive, and that plays into all understanding all of our recovery strategies for what we're doing with these fish, whether the flow and passage things as juveniles are working the way they're supposed to be working, or whether they're not, and this uncertainty about how many of these fish there are, just it kind of plays hell with doing everything with these fish.
So just to add to some of the stuff that Stuart was telling from the In River perspective, we take a lot of the information from In River management and produce ocean abundance estimates. So if you've got a problem in river in estimating your terminal run size or in estimating forecasts, it's going to sort of, cascade into the ocean arena, and you're going to have biased estimates in ocean fisheries. So this is for summer Chinook, this is for Lyons Ferry stock, this is for some of the fall Chinook stocks, which may not be a big issue because you're using coated wire tags, but nonetheless, we've got programs from the Pacific Salmon Commission to improve our understanding of fall Chinook, and we're using Bonneville as a facility to tag a certain percentage of the fall Chinook population so that we can get better estimates to Deschutes, to the Hanford Reach, and to the Snake River. If you've got temperature limitations and you're not getting enough of a sample size at Bonneville, we fail on that aspect as well. And millions of dollars are being put into these projects. So people have expectations from the ocean management arena, from Canada, from Alaska, that we meet these objectives for certain precision on our escape estimates to these populations. And if people can't go out and do their job at the AFF, there's repercussions from arenas outside the Columbia to it. So that's all I'd like to add.
Yeah, I understand that, and I understand you guys want to be as precise with your estimates as you can. I guess the question is, what can you do to limit the handling, and is Bonneville, it sounds like Bonneville Adult Fish Facility is very important to how you make your estimates, collecting your scale data. You said that you really rely on that data for upriver brights, summer and snake, Chinook, and you're going to need that from now till the end of whenever. How can you get that information if the AFF isn't available? And if it is available, then what's the minimum? How can we reduce the handling? Can we use video? Like for, I guess, the USV Oregon Harvest Management for steelhead, can you separate them out with video? I know video, there was some video work done the past year.
I might mention some of the visual estimation of A and B steelhead. For our typical a typical Chinook population with adults and jacks is often there's enough distinction between the large majority of your jack size fish and the large majority of your adult size fish, and there aren't normally a whole lot of fish right at the dividing line. And so we can and you use the window counts for adults and jack size fish. Even that gets into a bunch of debate about, because in the last we have had some issues with some larger size jacks returning, and Spring Creek Hatchery is notorious for having huge jacks and things like that. So it's not even perfect doing that, but it is a lot easier. But with these A and B steelhead, you know, unfortunately, for better or for worse, the 78 centimeter criteria between A and B steelhead is admittedly kind of arbitrary. It was developed after a long number of years of arm wrestling about how best to protect. Everybody concedes that there are these larger size, this larger phenotype of steelhead that mostly reside in the Clearwater and in the South Fork salmon and Middle Fork salmon. Concedes that we want to ensure that that phenotype survives and improves and that we have more of those fish. But exactly defining what those fish are has been a huge, it's got a 20, 30 year history associated with it. And we've, for better or worse, we've ended up with this 78 centimeter criteria, and there's a whole lot of fish that are just a little bit above and a little bit below. We've talked about just having somebody doing subsampling at the windows or trying to use video comments. Given the number of fish passing, the number of fish, you know, both fall chinook and steelhead passing the windows at Bonneville during the time when these B steelhead are passing, you can't squeeze these fish down to just, you know, letting one fish through at a time, or you'd never get the run upstream. So to get a really good look at the length of each steelhead that is pretty close to the line, we don't really think it's all that feasible to do that. You're going to end up with a lot of slop in trying to watch these fish go by and go, I'm pretty sure that was a big one, but not real big.
I don't think you can do it with a person, but I still like, you know, I'm like to explore and talk to people who use video imaging software. I think you can. Because the bodies, I think you can train the software to distinguish a steelhead from a chinook because the body shape's different. And you can, I'm sure there are ways to straighten the fish out, so to speak, if you get it at an angle or it's got a curvature in it. I mean, the imaging software is pretty sophisticated and it's used routinely and, you know, by hospitals and medical schools and everything. And I know they're counting cells, but they have some of the same problems counting something under a microscope as you do going through a window.
Yeah.
And I'm not up to speed on it, but I would think that's an avenue that could be explored. And I don't know, I'm not familiar with how Bonneville, what it looks like. I've never been there myself, but some people could look at it and explore the feasibility of this technology, and then where, if you could do it, where would you place the cameras to capture the images, and how would you sample them? Those are all technical and statistical questions you can answer. But the number one question is, is there software or some software available that could go through all these video images and, number one, sort out steelhead from everything else, and then measure them?
There's been people working on that, but yeah. It has not gone that well. It's a lot more difficult than it seems. I've got a lot of experience in that area. So there really is nothing out there that works right now. Could there be something developed? You would probably have to make some modifications to the Bonneville fish ladder to have any chance of doing it. Dan Routing actually had a proposal a couple of years ago. Last year, he worked with me on.
Yeah.
We're trying to get in that direction.
And one of the biggest things that we're struggling with is just the distortion.
Yeah.
Because you're like someone said, you can't neck them down.
Mm-hmm.
You can't neck the window or neck the crowder down to just have them go past equally spaced between the backboard and the window to get a real accurate length measurement, because the whole run wouldn't pass with everything else. So then you got to open it up. And then, so anyway, that was sort of one of the things. The other thing I want to talk about is that Rishi talked about small sample size, and that's an issue, but the biggest issue, or there's another issue, which is representative sampling.
Oh, yeah.
And so, so there's a concern about that. And I guess my question to you, Bern, is what's the issue with the handle rate? I'm confused a little bit with what that issue is. I don't understand it.
Well, it's sampling a percentage of the run. I mean, you don't know the fate of those individuals after you've handled them. I mean, the facility itself is hard on the fish.
I mean, delay.
It's.
I mean, you know that, man.
It's just.
It delays fish at the ladder, at the picket leads. So we have a delay there, and we're worried about that going on down the ladder. I mean, as fish come in, we have sea lions waiting for anybody who.
Delays entering into the ladder as well as through the track.
We're worried about delay all the way through. We're worried about handling effects. You know, Bonneville routinely turns in the highest mortality rates for adult salmon of any dam in the system.
adult mortality rates, how, Gary?
Dead fish in hand. Dead fish from the facility. We had fish killed in the facility this year. There were several adults that were killed in the process of handling before they jumped out into the, you know, in the ladder itself. We had a couple of them do that too. So, you know, there is an impact there.
Yeah. What is the percentage?
Oh, it's very low. It's low, although it's higher than anywhere else.
So,
but it also has, Bonneville has the most, by far and away, the most fish pass.
Well, I mean, we're talking zero everywhere else except Bonneville. Okay, so that's an infinite difference.
So we got a couple issues.
But I'm not done, Dan.
Okay.
There's the other part of this is just the actual handling of fish. And so you're handling the fish, you're putting it through anesthetic, poking and prodding, whatever you're doing, put them back in the ladder. We don't know what survival is on those fish to spawning. We know that they get up to McNary Dam and the conversion rates can be fairly good. We just don't know at what point there's an impact on those fish as they go on through their life cycle. And that's an issue that you may never know. And
well,
so it gets into a...
And I guess that's where I wanted to go a little bit. So back in the day, we didn't have pit tags. We didn't have a way to try to track some of that stuff. There's a lot of information with pit tagged fish that are not handled through the facility and pit tagged fish that are handled and fish that are actually pit tagged in the facility. So rather than throwing our hands up and saying, well, it could be high or we don't know, if this is a really concern, there's a lot of smart folks
well,
in here
have,
that could try to go ahead and I mean if we really ask the questions we might be able to work together to see to the extent that what we can answer with the existing information, and then if the answers aren't if the answers aren't meeting everyone's expectations, then maybe we could actually learn something. We could design something to learn something to maybe answer the questions. And that's all I'm floating out.
And I know, and we've asked this question of, University of Idaho has looked at this over the years, spawning mortality and pre-spawn mortality, those kind of questions. The problem kind of falls apart because radio tags, you don't have enough fish to ever say anything about that. The pit tags tend to fall out of the fish when they spawn, whether or not you can take out your wand and carcass and get a tag, whether that was, tag loss or actual mortality. It's easier said than done. It sounds like you ought to be able to do it, but University of Idaho has been trying to do this, Chris Peary and, before him, Bjorn. Those guys are really very smart people, and they have tried to work through this and not been able to come up with any good. Yeah, small sample sizes are always a problem, and so a lot of unknowns in there too. So, it seems like you ought to be able to do that, but we have not been able to do that yet.
Well, So part of it is that let's identify. I don't want to go too far in this, but. Let's identify maybe what we can do with radio tag data and pit tag data. Mm-hmm. And take a look at what we can do and what those answers are. And if they're not sufficient enough, we might be able to go ahead and address the questions in some other ways or some surrogates or something else like that. And that's all I'm floating out is that
well, I have no problem with
we
that.
Have
that's, we should be.
we have, you know, so the last time that I was really in there, it was back when we were actually trying to put the detectors in Bonneville. And I remember Earl and Sandy had really low mortality on those steelhead that we were tagging, that they actually videoed that went up. So and I know we were tagging into the 70s that summer. So all I'm saying is that there's a series of information that's going to take a concerted effort by everyone to try to go ahead and pull that together. And let's see what the answers are and see what the limitations of the data are. And then if there's really a need to do something, I think you'll hear from most of this group that we've thought about other ways to try to do this. We're stuck right now at Bonneville, for better or for worse, for scales and some other issues.
If Bonneville facility fell apart tomorrow, you guys would be SOL for management. You couldn't do it.
Oh, gosh.
You wouldn't know what to do. That's amazing.
Yeah. I think
you might want to think beyond this a little bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that sums it up. I mean, I don't, God, these guys would have to be working 24/7 for the next 2 years to figure out what to do, because it's been that,
we're at right now.
And it's that dependent.
That was not built for this group.
Yeah, I mean, that's really, that is a reality, guys.
It's not funded for that group, for us.
That's what this group's all about, is trying to figure out how we can, you know, there's the impact on one side of it, but I'm not going to run around trying to justify the impact if there's other alternatives that we can be using to get away from handling these fish on a yearly basis, at least as many as they are. There may be some, I can understand that, but we're having a lot of fish out there so we can harvest to kill more of them.
But it's also so that we can harvest and set harvest rates that kill an appropriate amount and be recovering that.
I understand.
That's from the
where harvest is going.
Yeah. So Dave, I guess my question to you would be is that I've been in the facility since the mid 80s, and we've always used it for this program. This is the first time I'm hearing someone say, "Oh wow, we never designed it for that program."
We didn't. And
it's been that way since it's opened.
It's been available because it was also being used for other purposes.
Right.
Those purposes are declining and may end, you know, in the near future.
Yeah. What are the things?
These are more for getting the general assessment of hydro passage, understanding where we had troubles to improve things for adult fish. Most of that's done. We use it now, you know, a lot of it is for small scale tagging for specific evaluations at a specific dam. And ITTAG has taken over for adult performance measures. So we, you know, the need for a lot of this stuff, for our uses of it, is almost going away. And you know, if we get performance standards and we meet them all over and over again, it gets less and less of need, maybe no need yet.
I think that's where we're going, is phasing it out.
Right, so it's a matter of it was being used enough to make it available. Where down in the future, we also started setting up some real intelligent, we thought, limits based on temperature and known temperature effects on fish when it gets, you know, above 70, above 72. These are really important too. These are kind of problems that are beyond just general survival through the system. When you start getting higher temperatures, they're known more detrimental effects. I think what we get to, especially with steelhead, is when you're using it 3 times and we don't allow it anymore for researchers because of survival potential issues, that's one of the key things. And that's why, just to say a couple things about the video stuff, if you do get a system, it can actually assess it fairly accurately, at least for, let's say, you may have a big area in the middle, you can't, but if you get a huge sample of the other fish, the big ones and the little ones, isn't that going to give you a pretty good ratio of what's likely there? I mean, you already know that the arbitrary ones are kind of those that overlap anyway. So, I mean, if you can get a system that can get you a bigger sample, in other words, can sample almost every fish going by, but has a big area in the middle that you can't tell them, doesn't that potentially give you even a more meaningful ratio of large fish versus small? Why not?
Because the way the system is, the way management is designed, it's at 78 right now. And so what you would end up with, you would end up with a large sample in the middle, which could essentially be assigned. They're unknowns. They could be assigned either way.
Right.
There's, it's very different.
Realistic.
Well, it's you have to deal with the catch as well. So when you catch a steelhead that's in that zone, which
well, I guess, but part wouldn't it matter how many there really were? We don't know for sure how good the system might work.
Well, I guess maybe we didn't outline this real well. Is that we're trying, based on USV Oregon, we're trying to manage separate populations or stocks. And so being able to accurately identify bigger fish and smaller fish is really important right now.
So you're getting into genetic sampling and all this stuff, you guys are going to get fairly you have to do down the road, is that part of it?
Well, eventually we may be able to. But USB Oregon right now says for 10 years, B run steelhead are 78 centimeters and larger. We can't change that unless we renegotiate the treaty.
I'm not saying you do, I just say you make a methodology that can distinguish.
Well, we have the methodology, and we are doing it, and we are doing it at Lower Granite Dam. Mm-hmm. You're not doing it at Bonneville.
We are going to do it at Bonneville.
You're going to try to do it at Bonneville. We'll see what the accuracy and precision is. But you still have to sample fish. You still have to handle fish. How are you going to? You got to get a tissue sample from a fish. So you still have to handle them. How are you going to do it? You just told me you're going to shut the facility down.
Well, I'm not saying that we are right now, but the point is if there are ways to reduce what we perceive and what NIMS has told us is a potential negative impact that may or may not affect our ability and our performance.
There are other methods than the length method. You know, genetics is one of them, but genetics still requires you to handle a fish.
Exactly.
So you have to have a facility to handle fish. So maybe, I don't know about Bonneville, but I know at Granite we don't have these problems. It doesn't seem we don't have the problems at Granite. So I don't know why the adult fish facility at Granite is so much better, and the adult facility at Bonneville is very bad. Maybe what we need to start thinking about is if we need Bonneville for the short term, the long term, whatever, and the facility is inadequate, we should look at ways to improve it.
Well, that's been out there
that's
for a long
other,
time.
That's the other option.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
And I'm not an engineer, and I don't know how it works, but I'm sure there's engineers who can figure out how to build a fish facility at Bonneville.
The problem is one of funding.
Yeah, it's a funding
yeah.
issue.
I mean, who's paying for it? Is it you guys around the table here? I mean, the agencies you represent, or is that just going to be a chip-in fund for doing this, or is it the Corps' responsibility to do this, or is this...
I can't answer that question. I want to know whether you can do it or not.
I mean, the funding isn't a job for anybody in this room. We're not in charge of funding stuff.
I just want to know whether you can build a fish facility there.
It is. We all work with money. It isn't going to get done. We can't come up with a way.
But
to fund
it's our bosses who's also
recognize
decide who gets to pay and how much they get to pay. And then
no one works around.
Well, that's not the way it works. We've got one of those NMOA projects for 10 years. It's got a significant chunk of several of their extremely bottom, though. I've been talking to John Reers that you did about chipping in some money to improve PTEG detection in there so we have a better record of fish as we sample them so they, as they go out, we have a tag detection and putting so there's some money. And it's all a question of what does it cost? What do we
well,
need?
Well, that's exactly. I think it comes back to the technical to determine what's really needed and how much that might cost. And then those will get elevated to policy folks for the splitting up of the, the queue that's out there.
Well, and then just as another
we
fact,
just can't say we can't figure this out, so you guys figure it out.
And then just as a background for the TAC folks, I mean, I think last year, for the 2009 season, we sampled 2,700 steelhead.
From June to
April. And then roughly 3,000 Chinook. Sorry, Jeff.
Sounds about right.
And 700 or 800 sockeye is a total number, and I think the mortalities were, Tammy, help, five, four? So
I know
four or five
there were probably at least that many. There were three or four memos sent out regarding Critchfick or mortalities found in the AFF.
Lose a few fish every year. I agree with Gary that the handling these fish is bad. Is bad for them.
The report is, well, we don't know what happened. It's just a little bit of dying. That's all it's going to
Well, I think one problem, of course, that I keep looking at when I go out there is that you can't monitor the fish, and you can't use the small recovery tank, and there is a place you could closely monitor them and keep an eye on them, and that's an opportunity for possibly some enhancements, because we used to be able to revive fish that didn't recover back years ago. Now we toss them in the braille pool, and it's very hard to keep an eye on them. So I think part of that is some of the rules that we're under. You only put one sockeye in the recovery tank now.
Having to have to recover them is an issue for me.
Yeah, we've always had a few every year that just don't seem to come out from the anesthetic. That's always been the case. I think you're better off having a live one coming out of it than one than a dead one. You have to write a memo on.
Well, the information that comes from those fish is so valuable. And I think under USV Oregon, we have research impacts that was going to pay for this fish. But for the small number of fish that we're handling and the information that we're getting from those fish and the impacts from that research that we're doing in that facility are going towards the
through the USV Oregon side of it. I just think that if, I think, when I look at 2,700 steelhead in a run of 600,000, and even if they all die, even though that's not all that's happening, I mean there's all the fish that are coming up the ladder that don't, and sampled, diverted through the system, which is, I don't like to see fish jump through a false wheel and bang their way down through a flume system to get back to the river.
Well, the entire Snake River run is doing that at Lower Grant. So during...
Okay, Lower Grant is on
and Lower Granite Dam, when they're... spring, summer, and fall there, they make every fish jump through one of two different metal tubes to go through the pit tag detector so they can do the sort by color.
We didn't talk about monofilm for now, but the deal is nobody bats an eye about there's no crisis situation
that oh my god we're destroying the Snake River run by running this trap at Lower Granite.
Well, part of, one step at a time, what we got to think about is that clearly we've had some really larger runs in the last 8 years, larger runs of salmon and steelhead, and I know that when pickets have gone in during some of those larger runs, there's been some delay that's been pretty significant down the ladder. So I mean, Gary's outlining that at some times there's some real issues that if you got out there and you stood on those pickets, they're piling up on the pickets. Yeah. Some are going in. There's a sort of bunch delaying. So part of other things to think about is that can we operate Bonneville?
We do.
To reduce the amount of fish in the Washington Shore Ladder and those types of things. But
the O&M arena
for
But we have, we do that. We have criteria set up that we split flows, the powerhouses, try to pull fish away from the Washington. And, you know, then we get in trouble for that because, oh, there's not enough fish over here.
So, I mean, in a lot of ways, in tack we live in one world, in fish passage we live in another world, and we don't always and we don't always appreciate and understand each other's problems. You know, if you're sampling at Bonneville, hell, if 90% of fish are going up Washington Shore, that means you can get your sample, get in, get out, and it's a good day.
Yeah.
We're not thinking, when we're doing that, we're not thinking about stacking up fish down in the ladder. But on the flip side, we're trying to come up with improved B-run escapement estimates at Bonneville to calculate harvest rates. It's really important in the biop. It's really been flagged for the region to try to deal with. And, you know, we just got to work together and try to pursue what we've got and maybe some other ideas
and move forward.
I
mean, really, from my standpoint, I understand the harvest needs. I'm not against harvest. That is not the issue here. What I want to do is improve this facility at Bonneville to the extent that we can, minimize the use to the extent that you can still achieve the goals you need to achieve. And if down the road I can see some light at the end of a tunnel that takes us away from heavy fish handling, I think that that's better for everybody involved.
And what's heavy, Gary?
Heavy?
Yeah,
well, having to be in there every year from the start of the season to the end of the season, 70-degree water temperatures or plus, that's a lot of handling at a facility like Bonneville Dam, where all of the fish in the region, or the basin, have to go up through that dam.
So, only one of the four fish ladders, though.
Very large.
Hmm? Only one of the ladders.
This is Chris Caudill. One of the ways of framing this whole issue is to come at it from, it kind of go back to something that was said earlier. If as a region or as a group, there could be some agreement about what a significant impact to the resource is, and everybody would agree that's a big issue, that would help frame whether or not the current AFF is a problem, the current practices are a problem, or not. And that's a discussion that will help shape any improvement to any of the facilities, because as long as there's any handling, there will always be handling effects. Some of those will be unknown, and there will be handling effects. But as long as there's agreement that the information in terms of management for the resource is worth those handling effects, then there should be no real issue. Is that?
Yeah, it's how do you, I mean, you
and
a bit
of course the bear is getting everybody to agree on what a significant impact is, and that's something that should probably be done across a couple of different run sizes, because it's smaller run sizes, then a couple, some percentage of the run is going to be a bigger impact than at higher run sizes. But I think coming at it from both directions, trying to estimate what the actual impacts are, is important, but that will always result in arguments and discussions just like this, as long as that's non-zero, which it always will be. And so coming at it from the other end, from the management end, I think is also equally important to define criteria by which there's acceptable performance of a research facility or a monitoring facility.
Now,
just
Chris,
like there
Chris,
are.
Chris, I'm going to ask you to fill in some of those blanks.
Great.
And there's some pretty big blanks in there that concern me, and really it comes down to the latent effects of handling.
Yeah, absolutely, and those are difficult to get at, but I think that as a researcher I can begin to address those as long as, and I can address those at the outset by saying, no, we can't figure this out if I need to tell you that it's less than 0.1%, if you guys decide 0.1% is unacceptable and my back-of-the-envelope calculations say that it's always going to be more than that, then we know that we have an
answer. I've been spending a lot of time looking at pit tag data and finding, and particularly this year especially, so I've been concerned with that picket, and I'm finding those pickets heavily bias our sample towards Jack having those pickets in. I've got some data here that I'll hand around. We can talk about it if you want, but we get about twice as many jacks when those pickets are down as when they're up. So that's heavily influenced our sample. But I've also been trying to look at some of these temperature issues. And one of the problems I have is I haven't really found anything significant in terms of, basically, I tend to be, so far, I've just been looking at how many fish go to McNary. But part of that is just low sample size, especially for Chinook, where it seems like there may be something there when they're sampling above 71 or so. But again, it's above 70, but again, it gets into what's an allowable effect. You know, it's a few percent less. I think it's like 671% or something going to McNary up below 70, something like 65, 66, but it's only about five fish worth, so it's small sample sizes. So it's kind of one of those things that I'm trying to look at, but I don't have any answers.
What does the ESA take permit allow?
We are allowed to, something like, actually I just reduced it. It's based on how many fish, and I'm sure Gary will bring that up, how many dead fish we have on hand. And it's something like, it was something like 18 or so, and this was just ESA fish. So you expand that by whatever the non-ESA is, and I've dropped it down to about 9, 8 or 9.
So, I mean, there's no issue.
Laced with last
one. I mean, based on our current, you know, actual drop, the mortalities you observe at the ladder, there's no issue. you're not exceeding your ESAP requirement. Latent mortality may be an issue, but I think we can estimate it. So, and there are ways of doing it. You've got pit-tagged fish, which haven't been tagged at Bonneville. You've got you know, basically a control sample.
The problem is it's kind of it's a different, I mean, sample is the problem. It's sort of apples and oranges. Well, it's a little bit difficult.
How far are you carrying it, too? I mean, if you're carrying it to spawning success,
and yeah, spawning success, that's tough.
Well, pit-tagged, really, you can only go to the uppermost dam.
It goes to grit.
Yeah,
you can follow them to the uppermost dam. There's a long life history that goes on after that you're not...
We've got ability to do with submersion of non-metal in Okanagan. You've actually got arrays in the cribs. You've got arrays in South Fork salmon now, and they're planning to put out in clear water too. There's one proposed in the Deschutes. There's one in John Day. So you can actually start addressing at least to the cribs now. Whether there's eventually, you know, pre-spawning mortality on spawning ground, you won't know that. But
that's exactly the same issue as any wild fish pit tagging project faces. If you're pit tagging wild fish, it's very hard to get enough dead wild carcasses from next to its red to know whether or not that wild fish that you pit tagged survived a spawning or not. That's always been
well. And the other issue is wild fish, kind of going to the more general thing about using data at Bonneville by other means with wild fish. Yeah. With hatchery fish, at least you've got some concept of what the tagging rate is.
Yeah.
And so you can start playing with those, and you've got some broodier information depending on what species it is. On wild fish, you've got a lot less of that. So there's an issue there that's not easy to get away with.
So what I'm hearing is that you want to justify this any way you can. There is no other alternatives to doing what you're doing. The end of the story. I mean, we're done. I mean, that's what you're saying. We need to buy that you can handle fish all you want, temperatures that you want. There's no effect. Leave us alone.
No,
what we're saying is that
the sampling programs have coverage under the ESA.
They do.
And as long as the sampling programs are within their ESA limits, I'm thinking none of us can figure out exactly what the issue is. If it were a matter that the sampling programs were killing twice as many fish as the ESA permits allowed, then there's some serious problems that need to be addressed as to whether the ESA limits are right or whether the sampling programs are doing
well.
Right.
Yes.
And
see,
the thing is, the fish passage plan where we have say how we're going to run facility, and that includes temperature-related use of this facility. You know, they're written out specific. They've always been applied to whoever's using that thing. They will impact your ability to
sample. That's part of the buyout.
And that's part of the buyout-related things, too. So these all come out from regional determinations of how we're going to run that facility under certain temperatures. So those are not, you know, I understand you guys have your realities and all, that's one of ours. And that's one's done through regional coordination. That's what we're going to run. So it's not like, you know, these are not arbitrary decisions on it.
Yeah.
So I would also say that I tend to agree that if we've got coverage, at least from the harvest end, that you know, more sampling is useful for us. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's no reason to ever try and make that mortality less.
I would never say that. My concern is that if we can do better, we should. And if there's ways to limit the amount of handling that we have, then let's try to do that for the fish's sake. Otherwise, I'm hearing kind of a...
Well, that's not
what I'm hearing, though. I'm sorry, but that what I'm hearing is we have our ways. We really aren't interested in changing that, and it's covered. So why can't we just take them?
No, I think
what should our alternatives be instead?
Yeah,
I guess from... I mean, we kind of went through what we do now. What is there some ideas? I mean, and you guys have talked about this.
Well,
I know you went through the notes.
I mentioned about three different methods, but they're not going to start tomorrow. We need some standard, and they may not be fit. We have to test them.
But there are
but there's some ideas. Are you willing
to look into it?
I'm sure.
Gary, I wrote a proposal a couple years ago and it didn't get funded about it.
Anything promising yet? But sure, if we're if we're able to develop a video imaging system that can differentiate fish by length like that,
are there other ideas out there that's great, but the problem is, I
suggest a lot of pit tagging of juveniles, but I can't even get the Corps to fund or BPA to fund Hanford Reach pit tagging, which
that's
seems to me like the number one one you try to do would be your start with your big wild stock.
Right.
And
right.
I have never been able to get the Corps to fund it. I had a highly rated project, and it got to BPA, and they said, nope, we're not funding it.
There may be other ways of going about that.
Yeah. Well, I think there's some options on the hatchery side.
And I think we can do it right now for Snake River because we have enough. But we have a program where all Chinook stocks get pit tagged at about 50,000 to 60,000 fish, and hatcheries. Now, I'm just talking about hatchery fish now. So if you can sample or pit tag most of the hatcheries, or at least a representative sample of them, throughout the entire basin, and get enough pit tags in as before you release them as smolts, so you get enough adult detections of bonville, you have your age comp.
For hatcheries.
Right.
That's what I was trying to point out.
But the problem is, it's going to be very, very difficult to do it for wild fish.
I know.
There's reasons
to do that, though. There's a lot of reasons to do that. It's survival. It's for estimating survival through a lot of the different
facilities. Right. But what I'm saying is we already have a pretty substantial pit tag program for hatchery Chinook in the basin.
For Snake River, Upper Columbia, Chinook.
I'm talking for Snake River, but that program could be expanded. It'd be worth looking at to see how large or an expansion or how many more stocks you need to pit tag to get a good age comp at Bonneville for Chinook.
Yeah, that's the sort of thoughts.
I think that's doable, and if a lot of these concerns are valid, which some of them are, and I agree, less handling better. I don't like handling adult fish.
Of course,
with pit tags, you need to tag a lot more juveniles.
Yeah. So let me see if I can get where part of why we ended up where we are. For us, right now, to deal with harvest cost effectively, it's easier to run the Bonneville trap than it is to get every hatchery group representatively tagged in the basin, all of the wild steelhead and salmon populations tagged within the basin. If we did that, we might not need the facility. However, where we've been right now, it's maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars for us to be at Bonneville to take a look at the tagging program we just talked about. Is probably many millions of dollars.
This isn't just for this issue.
Oh, I understand, Gary. Yeah. Pit tag and everything would answer a lot of questions.
Stocks across the basin would answer a lot of questions. The RM&E group is looking at that now.
It's going to be a region-wide pit tagging strategy coming up, so make sure you get it.
I think one of the other things to think about on the wild side, that I may be wrong, but for the hatchery fish, we have tagging rate estimates, too. Which you can tag a lot of wild fish and still not know what proportion of them you ended up tagging.
Yeah,
and you're going to need that too, which implies that you're going to need some pretty substantial stock assessments to go along with your tagging. So it's not just putting tags in fish. You got to do some population estimates, which is...
I've actually seen to add to his thing, the maturation rates of the hatchery fish and the wild fish can be way different.
Yeah, I have another alternative too.
This is for
Chinook. You can institute the parental-based tagging program at every hatchery, and then when you do that, every hatchery fish is marked. So when they come over Bonneville Dam, you only have to sample maybe 1,000 or 2,000 of them, and then you can be told exactly who their parents are. And what year they came from, what hatchery they came from, and when they were born.
So it's parental genotyping?
Yeah.
Yes, it's PBT. And that's a technology that works, and it's in its infancy in the Columbia Basin. But it's another way. But again, the problem with that is you won't be able to do it for wild fish, because for it to work, you need the database of all the parents.
And
at hatcheries, you can do it for hatcheries. What will require the hatchery managers to do is, whenever they spawn a fish, is to take a tissue sample. So that's another alternative.
$30 to $40 a piece.
but that's a situation where you're still going to have to get your mitts on the fish at Bonneville to sample.
Right. But instead of sampling tens of thousands of fish, that's you wanted to say how you reduce sampling. That's another way of reducing sampling.
So, Dave, let me ask a question. So, from the Corps' perspective, if we weren't sampling fish for harvest management, would the Corps close the facility? Does it see no need for the facility? Or almost no need?
Mothball is a better word, let's say.
You would?
It would probably be mothballed, yeah.
Okay.
We would just not be running fish through it if we weren't doing any studies for adults.
Right. So based on all the facility had a lot of radio tag work in the past. We've moved on to pit tags for assessing many of the things that we used to use radios for. And because we're pit tagging lots of juveniles, we don't need to put radios in.
Right, so
we're done. From the hydro system evaluation perspective. Yeah.
That's very likely, and we won't need to do that in the next 5 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good for us. I mean, that's good to hear that.
We're running out of things to test.
You know, for us in our planning and projected funding and all, that begins to not be on.
Not on the horizon.
On the horizon. Yeah. So why spend a lot of money?
We've got technologies to make place, it's just going to take a while to get them in place.
Kind of idea. And I think that's where it gets down to the... Where is the money going to come from if we do need that?
What worries me is that in a situation where we have a facility that's crumbling, falling apart, we don't have much money to put into it because you guys are shipping into it out of your pocketbooks because the federal side's not putting a lot of money into it or in the core, then it just gets worse and worse.
So what's required in terms of money? That's one of the questions, is what is required and how do we get it? Decide whether it's necessary and how do we get it? That's a big part of it.
Well, but from what I'm hearing, there's some let's just call them fatal flaws in the existing plan that gives you pause regardless of what the need is.
Not real happy with the facility as it is.
Yeah, so you're really, what should be on the table sounds like is improvements to that as well. If you're even going to continue.
A better facility out there.
Does every fish that goes up that ladder get shuffled through the trap?
When the pick of leads are down, all of them are down. Yes, we don't always use all of them.
We changed the picket leads this past year, though, so not all of them run through there. But in past years, all of them did run through there.
Well, bring that issue up. Does that really bias our sample?
Can we talk about that? Because I didn't really get into one of the hardest things that we're using with the scale data. Is that the scale data basically what we end up with? Is a sort of a grid that X percent of the fish are 1.1 jacks, Y percent are 1.2, and you end up with the different age classes of fish and you get these different percentages. And we're using that to construct these brood tables. But that depends on that you have to sample to run at you have to take a random sample of all the fish that are in the ladder. And what Jeff has discovered with this, and what also seems to be just comparing the age composition with the window counts, for spring Chinook especially, we sampled way too many jacks this year and the last couple of years, it seems. Jacks are going into that trap. I mean, obviously, this year we had way too many jacks in general. Yeah. But then we, on top of that, we sampled too many of them. And what that does is that that artificially increases the proportion of your total scales that are jack-aged fish. And so, if you take your entire run for like spring Chinook of adult and jack fish that were in the windows. And this year, it was 140 adults and 80 some jacks, so it's 220 altogether. If you apply the age data that we got at Bonneville this year, What happens is instead of that 80,000 jacks, you had like 120,000 jacks because you had so many jack age scales.
Disproportionate.
And it's disproportionate, and it totally outweighs. Clearly, this year we had a fair number of jack aged fish that were adult size fish, but even correcting for that, the scale data don't make any sense compared to the total run. And so what that does is that again gives us this huge uncertainty over how many spring shrimp came back last year. We're trying to manage we manage spring shrimp based on adult harvest impacts. So we need to know what the adult run size is. And if the adult run size was, as we think it is, 169,000 of the river mouth, then we were allowed a certain harvest on those fish. If the scale data were actually right, we don't think it was, but if it were, that would have put us down in a lower harvest rate. And that would be a case that if that scale data were correct, we caught too many fish.
So Jeff, can you talk about why it ended up that way?
Nobody is going to know the answer.
Isn't there a way now that you know this might be happening to correct it by the window?
Yeah. Well, we utilized the window counts. So we did, but we don't like the uncertainty. Yeah. We think it would be good if when you apply the scale data, and generally in the past it's been pretty close, if you take the scale data and apply it to the total run, you end up with about the right number of jacks and about the right number of adults, and we're concerned about we're breaking out the adult run by age to build into brood tables to do the forecasting.
I think the other thing it just raises questions on the whole, how representative is this? Because the same sort of thing could be happening with 4 and 5 year old fish too, but there's really not enough data there. I can look at jacks and non jacks and get enough data to make some sense out of it. What I found, if you look at the bottom here, is when the jacks or when the leads were down, 67% of the fish jacks or it was 67% of the run was jacks on the AFF side, and only 39% on the far side. Looking at those last two. Coils before they get to the trap. And you get similar numbers. There's no significant difference, and sample sizes are really small between what goes down the flume and what is at 12 and 14. Whereas if you look when the trap is not in operation, the other side is pretty close. It's 38% use the far side, 39% use the near side. Of course, this also, in terms of a trapping efficiency, reduces our sample too. When the trap is in operation, only 26% of the fish use the AFF side of the ladder, and 43% when it's not in operation. So we're getting a smaller sample, which I guess is one of the purposes of this. But we're also getting a very biased sample, and talking about using the ladder counts, well, I'm having a problem with my sockeye prediction. And unfortunately, the counters don't count jack sockeye, because I used my jack sockeye to predict my 4-year-old sockeye for next year. And I was expecting a fairly small run. 37,000 was the return 4 years ago, and you generally end up with a four-year life cycle for sockeye. But we had the record jack count last year. Is that a result of this or not? Unfortunately, there's no previously pit tagged fish out there for me to check on this. So if I use my prediction based on that jack count of 17,000, I'm going to end up with a prediction of about 170,000. 4-year-old fish, which are Okanagan, which is going to give me a total run of about 200,000. So my prediction is entirely based on this jack estimate. And I'm beginning to think the jack estimate is true, because I've got some other bits and pieces of data I'm putting together, but I think I'm sure would feel a lot better about it if I felt better about how representative our sample was.
Did you look at Brad Fry? Is there a difference in the percentage of jacks?
I have been looking between ladders, and I haven't gotten it. I'm not totally happy with the breakdown. The guy who's been doing this, breaking down this data for me, has not gotten to the numbers for that. So I want to look when the trap is in operation versus when it is not. I am finding that it seems like we're getting a little bit larger percentage of jacks on the the AFF side, or on the Washington Shore, and on the other ladders. But this is...
These are the same ladder, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but this is by far the most significant thing I've seen, is this right here. I'm trying to look at other hours and looking at just hours a day. I think something between the ladder we're at and the hour of the day, we're biased a little bit towards Jack's anyway. But this is by far the most significant effect I'm seeing, which just, it just seems to me that, you know, you're far better off if you want to reduce the number of fish going through the trap that run four picket leads, raise them, lower them, and do it that way than trying to, this is just, you know, from getting a representative sample, it's not. This new picket lead configuration. And I think Stuart had a good idea as to what might be happening, is that you're creating a, when you put down those picket leads, you're likely accelerating the water on the far side of the trap and making it a bit more of a dead spot on the near side. And that maybe the jacks being smaller might be more willing to go for the easier route, whereas the big Chinook may historically have said, you know, deeper water is probably better, and the faster water, that's where I'm going.
Have you looked at anything? Differences between species with pit tanks at all to see if there's differences in ratios that might be size related to
unfortunately
like
Chinook are really the only one there's enough pit tank fish out there to do anything with. You see, these sample sizes on the AFF side of the ladder are pretty small. I 20 out of 24 weeks we had a higher percentage of jacks on the AFF side. All the shaded ones are highlighted. And I suspect it would be quite a few more. It was probably a lot more of those would be significant if you started to add, if you got more data.
You could do it. Oh, if you hadn't to come over there.
Yeah, there just aren't enough.
But if you remember last year, last year we didn't have a center dividing the series of picket leads, and we had a pretty easy time getting our sockeye sample, but not Chinook sample.
Yeah.
Remember we were saying that sockeye was common.
So anyways, we
saw it without a center divider in there. And
it's only now we're starting to get enough tags to do this sort of thing. Last year, tag numbers were quite a bit less. I tried to do some of this sort of stuff for last year, but it really was hard to get enough tags to give any sort of significant results.
Did you look at past years, too?
I've tried to, but it's really this past year is really the first year we've had enough fish coming, previously tagged fish. It's just a question of tagged fish to really
been random reality
do too much. Well, I think we're just steadily increasing the number of fish tagged in this basin, and we're finally starting to get some enough adult returns.
I mean, 10 years of data, I don't know if it was under current circumstances. I don't know if it's really right.
But clearly,
we were right away.
This is right or wrong, it does seem fairly clear that if were to be a system where all the picket leads could be put down until they were able to divert some appropriate number of total fish into the AFF to work on and then pull the picket leads up. And whether that took an hour or 6 hours, it would seem like you'd be much more likely to get a pretty random sample of all the fish that were out in the ladder.
So the I just had
this. Wasn't that a part of the reason we went to that circumstance was because we were getting too many too quick?
But you could pull.
There's a lag time. There's a long lag time before we pull the leads.
I don't know exactly, but I think when I was running it, it seems like there's a half an hour lag time from the time you drop the pickets between, because they got to sneak up a pretty good ladder, then they got to get into the pool, and then they got to jump back out into the water. So it's hard to determine what you've got all the time. But I think you could make some efforts to determine what you've got, and you could cycle them on, half hour on, half hour off, something like that, or an hour on, hour off.
Yeah, I mean, and that's really going back to Lower Granite. At least in the fall season, they're doing a time based sample. So they determine a target sample rate. And if their target sample rate is 10% of the, if they want to see 10% of the fall Chinook, then they set the gate on this trap that simply opens 10% of the time. And so it'll open for a couple minutes, close for a couple minutes, open for a couple minutes, close for a couple minutes. And, it doesn't actually get 10% of the fish because the fish are waiting in the pool up above to jump down into this thing. But it comes pretty close.
But you've got more control.
And they got more control. So, and then, and so it it never, you know, it's not like there's long periods when they're taking all the fish. It's they're taking a few and letting a few go and taking a few and letting a few go. And you just do that more often. So if there was a way to run the picket, so you put all the picket leads down for a little while, raise them up for a while, put them down.
Not quite that.
The problem there was that the Corps is responsible for that facility, and the dead fish that result every year in that facility that are not claimed by the researchers, every time we dewater it, there are dead fish on the drain. And those, whose permit do those go on? So if it's the Corps' responsibility, we need to know when those picket leads are open and closed, and we don't have the time to stand over there and just watch the researchers
open and close. Some kind of log on it?
Yeah, we used to
have
a log.
And if it's forgotten or it doesn't get
done. No, it's some kind of automatic log that somehow...
It's not automatic. Well, you have to manually push the button for the four different picket leads.
It could be something that could indicate what position it's in, or you could always take video and have video records.
So if all the signatures are down, that blocks the whole ladder, and currently there's...
You could have some density, probably.
I mean, what was used this year?
Two?
I think, yeah. What, middle? No, one side.
Two on one side.
Bias from the side of the ladder, even if all the pickets were up or down, too.
Well, I think I addressed that in the back side of this. So the second table here indicated no bias when the ladder was up, when they're all up. It was 39% jacks on the AFF side, 38% on the far side. So only 1 week was statistically significant, and that was a real small sample size week. And that was the last week of the year.
Well, I think we've got to do this. I've got to sign off. Thanks.
38% of the jack. It was 38% jacks using the AFF side and 62% adults. 39% and 62% of the other versus 39 and 61.
So, okay. The main fish ladder has four picket leads, and then this last year we put the Corps put a center divider in, so we ran with these two picket leads up, and so we just had two picket leads going into the fish facility.
What's the water flow? Is it down?
It's flowing down.
Yeah. Okay, gotcha. Thank you. So that, the center divider, does that help keep people back and away from the pickets and going around?
Well, that was kind of the idea.
Has it improved the time delays in the past?
It has. Well, it reduced the number going in to the FF, so thus they would reduce the delay.
Yes.
Is there at least a minimal of like around 2 hour delay for any fish going through there?
When it goes in?
When it goes in.
About three quarters of the fish use the far side when it goes in. That's what the data includes, three quarters total. It's a lot less for jacks.
The size of try to give a subsample so that more would not have to go through the FF. That was the idea.
Well, other sample.
So, I mean, we understand that you're finding a potential bias, but we'd also like to know how real that is.
Not potential bias, it's an actual bias.
I mean, it's just something to think. Maybe it was 1 year that was this way, and next year it'd be different.
Oh, it's hard to imagine this. You're arguing against statistics here. We have
1 year.
But boy, it's sure consistent. 20 out of 24 weeks. I've got statistically significant results in about 10 weeks.
Overall,
it's for 39% versus 67%.
But I'd like to make sure that there's not a ladder bias then, too, because that's going to mess up your sampling.
There's a little bit of one.
I understand you guys need an extreme...
Unless you want to build another facility on the Oregon shore.
It's kind of a precision paralysis reality where a lot of us are getting in for a lot of things that we have requirements that are so strict for what we're trying to measure that it makes it really hard not to do it. Some necessarily potentially easier way or manageable way. But so it's not that we don't appreciate that.
Well, the easy way seems to me to one button, raise all four for a while, lower four,
Nothing comes for free, you know. I mean, if you guys got a lot of money to throw at it, we do all the stuff.
Right. It's easy. And that's what it was.
If you guys did go to that, I mean, I know there's an issue with the crew and staffing them there. They're not going to come and go. They want to be there as short as possible time, get their data, and get out of there.
So we understand.
Yeah.
It's just
a... So, so are the...
making it a practical management reality is not always as easy as
the way the trap's always been run.
So Tammy, is the trap operator still raising and lowering the gates, or is the core doing that now?
It's the trap operator, but the core being responsible will go over and check those picket leads. And there have been times when the leads have not been in the position they needed to be in. So it has led to the core wanting, or at least Bonneville Project wanting to simplify that as much as possible.
And we used to have a log for when we raised and lowered gates and what water temperatures were and those things. Does mm-hmm. that still exist?
Those logs do still exist.
And so are they not being used?
They are, well, the log is there, but they were there initially for Pitagas because they wanted to see when those leads were down for Pitagas.
Absolutely.
As far as the core ever using them to check when were those leads up and down, that was not really the purpose of them, and so that hasn't been common practice.
Okay, well, we've been keeping track of them, especially this year, so I could do this sort of thing real well, look at exact times the picket leads were down and do this sort of analysis. So I've been keeping real close track this year. I'm not sure in previous years how accurate it was. But we had it in general, but I'm not sure if it was as accurate as it was this year.
We've got to put this in perspective. I mean, this program really, it's fairly inexpensive for the researchers to get the information, and it's used in numerous forums. It's used for NOAA, for the hydrobiop evaluation. It's used in USV Oregon. It's used for forecasts, which are crucial to Pacific Salmon Commission, US versus Canada. It's crucial for Pacific Fishery Management Council, for fishing in the ocean and U.S. waters here. The Columbia River forecasting is the reason why a lot of the ocean management works, because we've got fairly good precision in estimates of the age structure. And it's a huge factor in the ocean abundance. It's about 30% of what's caught in the ocean. So the system is working for a reason, and it's worth a lot. So that's what you guys think it's not, but it's worth a lot. I mean, I'm trying to put this in perspective to you guys. So, you have to really think about what this information is being used for before you say, hey, we don't want this to happen. And if the impacts, you do a mark recapture estimate on any of these systems, there's going to be handling of fish, and fish are going to die. There's going to be a mortality on that. So handling fish will cause a mortality, so we're not saying, we're not saying push it to the limit or anything.
I'd like to minimize the amount of that effect on adults, really, if we can.
Yeah, and that's what we're trying to do, too. We're not trying to push it,
I'm not going to be, I know there's all kinds of purposes and uses, and I understand that, but we still need to minimize.
Yeah. But as we're thinking about the
how more minimal can you go? I mean that sounds to me. I mean, I'm getting the idea that 2,700 was too many fish.
Well, it's what's in the ladder is what I'm looking at. I mean, this is an effect on all the fish passing through the Washington Shore Ladder, not just the fish in our handle, not just the fish that die in John's hands. It's there's an effect on all those fish.
I'm a salmon killer.
But don't the pickets help appease that?
My guys.
Isn't that why the pickets are being used the way they are, because they help appease?
No, it just stops passage of the ladder.
Yeah.
You mean the modifications?
I mean, just the
that
way
made,
that you're operating.
This
they aren't all being
that
closed
helps.
At the same point.
Because those two
helps.
On the right were open, the two on the left are closed, but Jeff's telling us it didn't work.
I looked at the delay last year. I think it was like 2 hours or something.
Dan
like the
was
delay.
Trying to bring up was, reducing the handle, I think we can all go for that. What is acceptable and what isn't?
There's two issues here. One is, it'd be nice if we didn't have to handle them at all.
Right.
That's where I would like to go. I know we're not going to get there early.
We're not going
to
be there.
But I'd like to. I understand that. What I don't see and what I want to see is some movement in that direction, at least investigations in that direction. And, you know, I'm hearing some of that here, which is good. I just don't see it on a piece of paper, you know, or if there's any way that we can capture this, if you guys are willing to play the game or not, I don't know. You know, you just make it up and walk out of here and say, forget you guys.
No, certainly.
If we're willing to work on this as a team, you know, what I would like to see is us actually list these harvest needs, the methods that we're using. Maybe you already have that written up somewhere. The methods that we're using to achieve those needs. Alternative methods that could be used but aren't because they haven't been developed yet, or there's other ideas. How can we get funding towards those ideas to improve and maybe make them useful for us in the future for harvest management? That's what I want to see. In the meantime, and what I don't really want to talk about today is how to make this trap better. So that's another discussion for another group of people. I'd like to have some engineers in the room and that sort of thing. I'm more interested today in hearing how we can move forward towards reducing our reliance on trapping and handling fish at Bonneville Dam. And I'd like to see that be a flagship for the whole region, not just for Bonneville Dam. We can carry it to Granite, we can carry it to the Willamette, we can carry it up
so
to another system.
You know, for the harvest stuff, I think, you know, we've talked about a couple ideas, you know, more representative pit tag sampling. TAC has advocated for that for years. And not just for this, you know, as a supplement to go to water tagging and things like that. You know, we had ideas about steelhead with the, you know, video imaging or doing other sorts of things like that. And so maybe if some of these things should come to pass over the next 10 years or so, we can, you know, start reducing the dependence on the harvest management. But there's also the issue of the programs that are funded under the Accord projects, that basically they were initiated and funded and designed to utilize the AFF at high rates.
Yeah, there's.
If we're going to all of a sudden say that. That, you know, so we've got this pit tagging thing. We're supposed to be catching a ton of fish, of adult fish, and sticking pit tags in them and following them around where they go. We're supposed to be collecting all this genetic data
for the next 10 years.
And I mean, that just amazes me with all the discussions we've had the last 5 years over the same facility and being concerned about it. And over those same 5 years, there's another group of people deciding how they're going to use it more and more and more.
That's the sort of disconnect that we have.
Call Mask and we could pit tag like 17,000 or 20,000 steelhead at Bonneville.
Yeah, that's the disconnect I'm having, because a lot of these
other
forums are relying on...
He's with you.
He's with you.
NOAA, that's exactly the
frustration we are having, because these are things that wings of your department have been saying to do, and then we hear something exactly opposite from you guys again.
So I want to make one comment.
Yeah.
So Stuart said, well, we tag a ton of fish. The reality is that for most of these programs, we've tried to take a look at sample sizes to achieve some objectives. So I don't want you to think that we're just going in there to try to grab everything that we can. We've tried to take a look at what we need to tag, how to make that representative, and try to have a game plan about that.
There's another group, and another group. And pretty soon it gets to be quite a few people, you know, fighting over the facility, really.
Right. I think CritFix's largely been the only one that's been in there for a number of years. I mean,
Oregon.
We haven't been in there in a long time.
We've had our battles in the past. I know.
Well, and really,
Show me some love.
He's calling you a fish.
No, it's not you and me. I've seen it between the three of you.
CritFix inherited the steelhead sampling
from Oregon and Washington
that didn't have the money to do it.
Because Idaho's been in there too.
And it wasn't going to get done at all unless, but NIMS is paying for it.
University of Idaho.
Because NIMS is the one that NIMS, you know, from the tribal perspective,
those are core projects.
I think some of our tribal policy folks would be hell with steelhead sampling. Let's not sample a single steelhead, and hell with the bee index harvest thing. It's a pain. They don't like it. It's a hassle to do. They'll just go out and set a harvest rate on the entire run and use the window caps. That is, a lot of our tribal policy people would be perfectly happy doing that. But we've got other folks, you know, we're trying to work together on these things. So we're stuck in the system. So, you know, so it wasn't the intertribe that asked for the steelhead job. We were given it just because NIMS said, well, who's in there? And, oh, we're in there doing Chinook. Okay, you guys do it. Here's the money I do it. So.
And then the idea for the MOA projects, you know, the Pitcairn project and then the GSI project was to try and get stock composition and escape, you know, improve escapement estimates with what we sample, which is a much lower rate than doing some sort of a, you know, we've had estimates as high as like 2% of the steelhead run sampled at Bonneville Dam to get the appropriate estimates. And so the idea with the Pitcairn project, the idea with the GSI project, is to see if we can do that with genetic stock identification and then with the market capture of pit tags, which can have a lot higher sample size than what was done with radio tags. So that was the thinking with those two projects and getting them funded through this. So it wasn't just a willy-nilly, give us money so we can tag more fish. Yeah.
Okay, but the point is there are other people that are not at this table that want to handle a hell of a lot of adults, both Chinook and steelhead, and put pit tags in them throughout the run.
That's pretty much what we're doing already. So.
Well, not 17,000. Nowhere near what is being proposed.
Yeah, I know. I mean,
nowhere near, and it's being proposed to be done at several dams, not just Bonneville.
It's what, 20,000?
I don't know, but it's scary. It's scary. Pretty soon, almost every adult's going to have a pit tag in it.
Just
one thing,
but that's the disconnect. Yeah, that's part of the disconnect.
When temperatures, let's say, potentially increase density, to increase. I mean, are you guys thinking of any kind of limits on temperature realities?
Well, we have. I know. I guess granted, we have temperature limits.
What are they specified?
I'm not positive, but I do know they ratchet it back. I'm pretty sure when it gets around 20 degrees, which I think that's a little high. Personally, they supposedly stop sampling, and temperature does become an issue at times, and that's another problem. But relying on physically handling a fish to get estimates is because there's going to be windows in certain years where temperatures are high, and you probably don't want to be handling too many fish.
They're basically the same rules we have.
But granite only got there is because of Bonneville.
Yeah, I know.
But at the same time, you have pit tag data to take a look at immediate temperature effects if you choose to. Mm-hmm. There is that data that's available. And I guess my other comment would be is that steelhead, red band steelhead, especially in parts of the basin, have evolved under different temperature regimes.
There's something.
And so if you take a look at what those poor fish have to do over in the John Day Basin, it's pretty remarkable in terms of their tolerance for temperature.
If we only had those fish in the
lab. Yeah. So anyway, I don't think anyone is disagreeing about the whole temperature thing. I think what I'd like to see is to try to understand a little bit more about the temperature effect rather than, you know, because you two old-timers have been here when we went through all this stuff after listing in the late 90s, and we went through some ideas about that. We didn't have pit tagging at that time, but it would be nice to take a look at, are we seeing effects of temperature over the ranges that we're tagging at right now?
I've been looking at it. There's really, so far I'm not finding anything significant. There's a trend towards higher mortality and higher temperatures. We don't have enough data because we're not tagging enough fish.
We're talking about straight escapement to McNary.
McNary.
The problem is the sample sizes get even smaller if we wanted to, you know, track sockeye to Redfish Lake,
right.
I mean, you could do that, sure. But you don't get many fish back to Redfish Lake, so But
I mean, a lot of these, as you know, are standard reality but, protocols of handling.
I guess the problem I have is that one of the problems I have is with the stopping at 70 on the way up, but waiting until 69.5 on the way down, especially for fall Chinook. Well, steelhead are impacted too, and kind of what's the biological rationale for that?
And that's
management reality reasons. Yeah.
And just well, what ends up happening with both Chinook and steelhead is that about 15% of our sample covers about 40% of the rim.
So, and just what Dan was saying though is that with this texture thing, is that I think this would be a worthwhile project for us all to be involved in. Is so the Columbia gets pretty darn warm now. You know, if those folks in Copenhagen are right, it may get a lot warmer in the future. It would be good to get some understanding about what the effects of temperature are on these fish. And, you know, it's not only going through the dams, it's, release mortality in fisheries, it's all kinds of things. There's a lot of stuff we don't know or we don't have good data on, you know, whether these fish are, how they're responding to higher temperatures.
Well, we do. I mean, they've actually been quite a bit done. They go find refugia at many places when they're in the river where they're capable of doing it.
Well,
And the ladders, they aren't. So that's one of the problems there.
But one of the odd things.
The reality of the effects and where it happens is part of the difficulty with this kind of system.
But the thing is, so we get, you know, when the temperature heats up every year in August and stuff, we're getting a huge percentage of the total summer steelhead run is choosing to pass Bonneville at those really high temperatures, and then they disappear into Drano or someplace. We don't see them in the fisheries until September, and they don't pass the valves until September.
Chris will tell you where they are.
But they're hiding in there someplace. So I think you're right about the refugia, but the fact of the matter is that the high temperatures, the steelhead don't seem to mind passing along with the high temperatures.
Chris,
they seem to like to pass steelhead.
He's signed off.
He's
off.
I can tell you what it was. It was just that just about every steelhead that went to Idaho either dipped into Drano, Big White, or the Deschutes. Right. It's rare to get to Idaho without finding refugia.
And that's fine that they're doing that. But they don't.
What it showed was that those that did not do that had less lower escape as well.
But the ones that are.
So in other words, it does relate to an exposure time to that higher temperature.
And but these fish have been in that temperature since Longview.
Right, and they have.
And they've been passing through there,
also done temperature tagging with recapturing lower ground. These guys they go through a ladder and then they drop down to cold water and stay there.
Yeah.
So they have behavioral capability to do that a lot of places. So we're not saying that away from the dam they don't have strategies they could use to survive. Mm-hmm. But in the dams they don't. There's nowhere they can go to get away from the temperature.
And
if
guess,
we're delaying them an extra 2 to 3 hours at a high temperature, that may be not good.
So why
can't we develop a question to find out if that's not good? So far, Jeff has not seen any difference in looking at the type fish.
What you're asking is that we should trap fish at the high temperatures.
Well, I don't know if it involves
to get enough tags and fish to do the testing, and that's
what I didn't even know if it means consciously trapping more fish at high temperatures. Maybe it would, but working on some sort of an experiment to find out whether this temperature is a big deal or not.
Under the things that are happening now and happened at me.
We would know tag fish that are already tagged.
Help me out.
Maybe the real strong effects happen at, you know, they start to happen at 78 degrees. Maybe actually we start seeing some sort of important sublethal effect at 68 degrees, in which case our temperature criteria right now is wrong. But the trouble is we don't have any way right now of knowing. 72 is just 72. It's based on a bunch of literature from sticking fish in fish tanks and labs and things, but it's but it's not based on the Columbia River.
So help me out, guys. When I was trapping, when we used to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we were done by 10, are we still doing that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So we are trying to trap during the coolest part of the day, and then during the warmest part of the day, those pickets are out, and we're letting them go. Is that true?
Right. You can still have high nighttime temperatures. Yeah.
Well, you're right, Dan.
So we are taking...
We're good there. It's just that when the temperature's at night, the whole time,
I think the protocols are good. It's just a matter of how far do we push that if we need this bigger, more sandwich?
Well, and the trouble is, though, that it's a very subjective call to know how far to push these protocols, given that the information collected is important, and the mortality associated with pushing the protocols is unknown.
But testing, what you really want to do is test the handling effects at those temperatures, which means running the trap and effectively testing.
And then, we'd know whether or not it's a.
You're not going to get people to buy into this.
So hold on.
I'm not going to risk the entire run for that.
Hold on. Could we trap hatchery fish and test them?
But you're going to trap all the fish that go through the ladder, whatever.
We're going to trap them. I guess we would handle hatchery-only fish. Could we do? I mean, I'm just trying to float out some ideas that that are getting at Stewart's idea that 70 is our best guess.
70 is where it starts.
And so what if it's 66? What if it's 68?
They've done, like you said, a ton of laboratory studies, both with physiology and physiological effects, behavioral effects. I mean, they're not. It's not like it's isolated.
But you're trying to get people to buy off the fact that temperature doesn't really matter, so we're okay. And I don't think you.
No, I guess I'm not saying that. I heard Stewart say is that, well, if we're going to be doing this, maybe we ought to think about what the appropriate criteria is based on the Columbia River.
Well, let's test what we have now. The period that we're actually sampling, we could look at that and see how well that works, how well that looks. At least we go up to 70. You know, I mean, you have that range to look at.
Yeah.
And well, if your mortality is really high or unacceptably high at that, you know, it's...
One problem,
probably not going to be better going up.
So one problem you tend to have when you start looking at wide range of the temperatures is that it's confounded by other conditions as well. The temperature tends to go up very slowly in June and July. Typically,
so
and then it peaks in August.
Different stocks of fish.
Yeah, you got different stocks of fish.
You know, anytime with adults, unless you have almost instantaneously lethal effects, that's the reality of all adults. And that's why you have to come with time, rely on what you learned in the lab versus the behavioral realities, combining them, whether you're going to be slightly conservative or not.
I mean, our criteria through our Section 10 process was that we did not handle salmon above 68 degrees, period. And all of a sudden, they disappeared. So I'm wondering, I mean, that's another internal issue that I still haven't quite figured out what happened. So there's lots of those within our agency.
In the late 90s, we had no restrictions at all in terms of when we sampled.
68 degrees was
the
limit.
After listing. Prior to listing, Jeff's right, there was no shutdown at Bonneville.
Even the 90s.
Right.
The early 97,
98.
Yeah,
doesn't mean that
was right. Right.
There's nothing in our permit that says anything about temperature. temperature.
Maybe that's so hard.
So anyway, it just seems for 2010, while it would be, we can continue to advocate for better ways to measure steelhead and more representative pit tag sampling and other things.
Let me stop you there. I know where you're going, but first there, let's stop right at that point. Is that lip service, or are we really going to work on that?
The problem is that we have spoken to our respective bosses and told them for years that things like more representative stock-based pit tagging would be a good thing for the management of in-river fisheries. It would be a good thing for supplementing the coated wire tag program. It would generate lots of assorted interesting scientific things about, you know, answering questions about these fish. And so far, you know, the response has been, well, that'll cost a hell of a lot of money. And
but there's more to gain than just those
yeah.
items you're going
to. So yeah, no, there's a lot to gain. And so so I think we would continue to advocate for better representative stock-based sampling and working on trying to solve some of these puzzles about how you deal with wild fish, because barcoding every hatchery fish has certain benefits and is a lot easier to do. Figuring out what to do with the wild fish and how that impacts, that's a tougher nut to crack. So, those sorts of things. Yeah, we're all.
They've been written down, though. That's what I'm asking.
So, Gary, I'll float out the proposal that I wrote about doing video at Bonneville to try to do A's and B's. I'll float it out to you. Yep. If you can get some funding for support, we'd like to do that. I'll send it to Alan. So I'll send it to the group.
I like that.
Are there any RPAs that specifically mention things like fit tags for these kinds of tasks versus other tasks?
Well,
everything has been done with all the wide forms that everybody in here and everybody in here who has people that work and go over.
Dave talked about it. That there is a group,
pit tag group.
That's trying to deal with pit tag a coordinated approach to pit tag monitoring in the Columbia Basin. I'm not sure. I don't know much about the group, but it's trying to get at a bunch of different things.
Tracy Hillman.
Tracy is
heading that group up.
There's a huge effort coming up through their regional harmony and everything we've been doing just with the hydro system to get all the people together and try to make a smart regional strategy for who you pit take, who you want, quantities you pit take. So this obviously has a place to be.
And that's supposed to happen pretty darn soon.
In January, there's some January.
Yeah. So
there's people in this room, the TAC folks that are involved in that, then, I hope.
We're involved in it. Right now, it's part of the BPA, NOAA, mostly BPA and Northwest Power and Planning Council. They're RM&E, looking at RM&E across the base, and there's been a whole bunch of work that was done this fall on developing a coordinated RM&E plan. It was mostly based in the tributaries. There's the main stem issues are kind of were left hanging, and one of the main issues is this pit tag group to look at all the needs, not only main stem issues but also tributary, and try to tie in all the needs together and developing kind of a comprehensive basin wide coordinated pit tag plan. A lot of the pieces are there already. You know, the CSS study ties a lot of the hatch. In the Snake Basin, we're, I think, much further along than the rest of the basin, it sounds like, because we have pit tags in every group of steelhead and chinook that go out, except for fall chinook. We already are doing it. So, depending on, you know, what the needs are, the sample sizes are probably pretty adequate because the numbers we're tagging, I mean, if the SARs are that much in the toilet, you don't need to pit tag twice as many fish to tell you that the SARs are in the toilet. So those numbers, I think, are pretty solid. I don't think they need to go up. What probably needs to go up is the expanding that to the rest of the mid-sea and the upper Columbia.
Well, and it's something about the, you know, expanding the pit tagging, you know, tons more fish. It is not always going to be super easy because, especially for fall chinook, a significant amount of our fall chinook production are sub-earlings.
Right,
and these fish are most of them are cut loose at sizes which the mortality associated with pit tagging is going to be a big deal. I mean, you make a huge impact.
You have a tagging effect on the other thing that this group was
good.
The other thing that
for now.
The other issue that the group will probably grapple with is it'll probably be easy to pit tag. You know, obviously, it's easy to get the sample size for hatchery fish. It's just go to raceways. But it's not going to be very easy to get representative sample sizes, adequate sample sizes to do everything everyone wants to do for wild fish.
Right.
And tagging rates.
You know. And the other part that I think that this group, I hope they tackle and look at, is this, was alluded to, is pit tagging of adults. And the current strategy that seems like a lot of people are proposing to get, especially for steelhead, they get stock-specific escapement estimates, is to pit tag thousands and thousands of steelhead at mainstem dams and detect them with pit tag arrays. Well, I have issues, number one, with the handling and tagging that many fish, and I have issues with making escapement estimates based on pit tag arrays. Which I'd like to talk to Rishi sometime about. But those are technical issues, but there's a very real...
That's where you get whether you can have surrogates in there.
Right. But there is, and that's, you know, we talked about this disconnect. And, you know, we want to try to, we've been talking about how to minimize handling adults, and there's this other group of people that are not at this table that right. are pushing for, advocating for, we want to pit tag 10% or 20% of the wild fish that come across dams. Yep. Well, I think some alarm bells should go off.
Definitely. They are. Is it that high? I mean,
oh, yeah.
So from the Oregon side, 1% I think
of sample rate will give you
pretty good for us.
Estimates on.
We're having inside.
They're talking thousands of steel.
That doesn't make any sense. The inference is based from it's a binomially distributed thing. So,
but they're going to all these different places.
The 1% will give you, because if you've got a good count at lower granite, you use that proportionality.
Well, we don't need
a small population. Handling fish less.
Population of 200 fish. We don't need to pick a tag. We could do it.
You know, you don't get yourself out of the box by simply shifting handling adults to handling juveniles. And so, you know, there's trade-offs there. You have to weigh the pros and cons. You can't...
you see more value out of it. If there's a sort of a value added, we can get a lot of information.
Well, yeah, and that's... You've got to kind of do some cost-benefit analysis on where you're going to handle fish and when and the types and the value of the information you're going to get from it. So, but I think... perfectly happy. I think we can carry on those sorts of discussions to do more and better stuff like that. That's not a problem at all.
One of the things with PSC and ocean management is you always want to improve on what you're doing. So there's avenues outside of here where funding is required to do some other studies. We have process and an RFP
you
process.
You have your hands on fish in other places besides Bonneville.
Yeah.
Those tank fish can help you.
Exactly. There's lots of things which we had this meeting a couple of weeks earlier. We just worked on an RFP for the upcoming year for what would be high priority items to, you know. We didn't look at.
Because of the negative issues with wire tagging everything.
Right. But this pit tag group, didn't finish my train of thought, but the pit tag group, they're kind of working on, it's a kind of an assembled by invitation only group right now, but there's...
Is this the steering committee, or is this...
I don't know, it's
different.
It's the BPA, NOAA, mostly BPA and Northwest Power.
Okay.
And there's the plans are to have some workshops and planning, you know, open to all the agencies and tribes and after the holidays.
So one thing I guess we could consider doing.
So that is going to happen.
Is it's actually related to some stuff I was trying to work on this year, with using pit tags on only the hatchery side for spring Chinook to reconstruct the broods and stock up and all that stuff for just the hatchery side, because we have the tank. I haven't gotten very far in that, but it's something we could look at in TAC to examine the age composition and possibly put some, you know,
analysis into how strong they are versus
and gold ray down on the road.
Well, versus the scale that we've got now. You know, it might give us some insight into what we need to do for the wild side.
One of the things also with transitioning these databases. So if we're, you know, and you know, Chris has started working on this, but we have to go through a kind of process of we can almost guarantee that PIT tag based age data, it's not gonna, you're gonna end up with some apple and orange issues compared to scale data. And so you'll end up having to go through a time period where you get both sets running so you can compare the two sets so you get
calibration period or
yeah, so all of these transition things end up taking more time and more work than you thought they were.
I don't think this is gonna happen overnight.
Yeah.
Well, and we do have PIT tag data for multiple years now that's backing up, and you know we're starting to get more and more over time as we get more tagged fish coming online. The last few years we've got quite a few, so we've got some data out there. Whether we can find a way to adequately use it or not, if we can, we've already got part of the side by side base.
Okay. And one of those attack processes for determining how you have the precision and all that. Do you, I mean, is there any flexibility in that down the roads?
You know, the so
sampling. Yeah, yeah, we kind of guess how do you get a representative number, you know, whether it's like say surrogates, whatever.
So with the so for sample rates for scale data, there are some statistical processes you can go through so that if you're sampling something and you're putting the data into categories, which is what we do with scale data. So you get, you know, five or six sometimes different age groups that you're putting all the data into. There are some statistical methods that you say if my sample size is this much, then I've got a, you know, like a 95% confidence interval with a, you know, plus or minus 4 or 5% error or something. You can go through these things, and they're written down in books, and clever people can figure that kind of stuff out. And but the trouble is, so the generally, and TAC doesn't always necessarily, we don't have a huge number of real hard and fast rules, but we try and follow the typical stuff that ends up in gets published in papers, things, you know, like using a 95% confidence interval and stuff like that. So, but with these scale data, if we're, you know, given the number of categories of ages that we've got for Chinook and things like that, for these scale data to get a big enough sample to get like a 95% confidence interval around these individual estimates, where you really got the number of 5-year-old fish that you thought you had, you end up with weekly sample rates that are up in the range of like 400, 450 fish. And we're not getting those sample rates. And so, you know, and we've been using this data for years like this, and, you know, because we have to use it. It's all the data we got. But we would like to be able to get these things so that our estimates, because, you know, we get beat up in all sorts of forums. You know, we're trying to tell, you know, the fishing constituencies and stuff, there are this many fish, and we told them last year, your forecast 300,000 fish. And then it, you know, comes in way less than that, and people go, well, you know, how do you do these forecasts? How do you, you know, do you have any certainty on these forecasts? And we go, well, you know, we got these data, and that's what it tells us.
But even if you had the sample, the assumptions that are not met half the time are huge anyway.
Yeah. So, but in general, that we think that in a lot of cases, such as with these scale data, and such as with the B steelhead data, if we could up these sample rates, the typical sample rates, we're sampling something like, it ranges from week to week and year to year at sample rates between like, you know, 0.2% of the weekly run to, you know, sometimes an annual run for steelhead up to, sometimes in a really good week, we might get, 1.5% of the weekly run. ages ago, we had targets of sampling 2% of the runs. Those were the agreed to targets.
We were, and back in the day, we were pretty close to sampling 2% of the steelhead run.
Runs were small.
And,
runs were small.
Runs were small. But we were in there a couple days a week.
Right.
So anyway, we're sampling a lot less now.
So the other thing that brought it home for me, regardless of the confidence limit that you're trying to put on it, was when we went and tried to reconstruct the B steelhead, and you can pool the data in a couple of different ways, and you can pool them in slightly different orders between hatchery, wild, and big and small. And depending on which of those two methods you chose and tried to compare the two, you got wildly different numbers because of the sample size.
And
the variability in how those pooled. Those should be closer together. And if they were closer together, whether it was 90% or 95% or 80%, better about it. But that's just one of the things that's just a red flag.
But part of it is that you're missing a good chunk of August. And so you don't know what's going on in August, and that's another source.
Because it's all about settings.
And
when you have a bigger sample size, it actually makes it
longer.
August 1 is the
first piece.
You have a better harvest rate than the peak. I mean, that doesn't really come out to give you a better real.
We haven't had a decent sample.
We've
always had a situation of 15%. With something like 10-15% of the sample representing 40% of the run.
And
200 fish representing, 300,000 or 400,000.
Situations where our estimate of bee steelhead, of wild bee steelhead, when we were trying to do wild bee estimates, we had that one year in. It wasn't the early 2000s that we had a wild bee estimate of at Bonneville that was about 6,000, and then we had some harvest on top of that, and then we had 8,000 wild bee fishing granted. So there's some big questions about how many fish we've got with these bee steelhead running around. It just a lot of these data don't make sense. And
that's one of the things I pit tag stuff was going to say. I've always been suspicious of the general rules, like 78 centimeters is the magic mark dividing line. I'm going to be real curious to Stuart was asking about these steelhead early years. Where are the bees? And so we checked the fish tag, and there was only, at that point, this was in early July or early something in August, there was only one fish that had gone past the jerry. It was a bee, and it had gone to Wells Dam. So it was either a lost bee or...
And
no
one did find it, but that one
really going on, right?
Yeah. But talking about the things that are going to help refine this, so some of the things that we're also trying to do by using the AFF, some of the genetic work and some of the adult pit tagging, where if Jeff had not had this MOA study this year in which we were pit tagging adult steelhead, we've got this great thing now so all of the fish we have measurements of steelhead and whether they're A or B fish by our harvest definitions. And now this year is the first year we got this really cool data set that we're able to track these fish and see where and when they went. And that's been one of the huge things that we've always debated about. And people giving a hard time about, so you get these big fish, but there's tons of big fish going over Priest Rapids. And it turned out that one fish that went up there, up to Wells early, was just about the only fish that went up there. But that helps settle that debate. And so that's not even exactly the use by which the Accord project doing the adult tagging was set up for, but we're able to jump onto that and do this, and so it helps refine our, so there's a whole bunch of things that we want to and are doing to help refine this stuff, but some of them still involve.
I can give you another example of where this tags have become useful in season. Is the WDFW debating whether to have a sockeye fishery in Lake Wenatchee, and they had based on the dam counts between Rock Island and Rocky Reach, there were 30,000 fish returning to Wenatchee. And Andrew Murdoch took a look at the pit tag data and said, no, there aren't. All the pit tag fish, mostly ones we've done, but some they did, were accounted for. that WEFW went ahead and had a fishery anyway. In their count at Tumwater were 16,000, so somehow the Rocky Reach count's way off. But there's an example where the, you know, the pit tag data. Last year, too, we observed the issue of tremendous delays at Tumwater, where they're handling every fish at Tumwater. They want another worse situation than in Lower Granite. They're just trapping every single fish, and it was taking 4.5 days last year for the average fish to go through Tumwater. For sockeye. Spring Chinook as well.
So for 2010, I think from the harvest perspective, we are, I think I'm speaking for all of TAG, but we are concerned about the bias in the Chinook data. We want to make sure, just because we get so roundly beaten up by our bosses and every fisherman in the world for having messed up these forecasts and things, which are based on these age relationships, we want an unbiased age sample. And so if that entails, doing something with these picket leads, like putting them all down, or all pulsing them on and off, or something. And it seems like there's got to be a way to do it, because they could do it at Lower Granite, and certainly you guys aren't going to be outclassed by the Walla Walla district.
No pressure, Dave.
So
Tammy didn't capture the notes, so don't worry.
But the recording's on.
There's got to be a way to do it, and so and I'll admit, I'm no expert on picket leads and things like that, but there's got to be a way to catch a representative sample of those fish.
And minimize your
impact. I'm more of an expert of picket leads than I am of harvest issues.
So
I think we can do that.
Yeah.
It's the core is whether they're willing to.
We can also do an analysis.
We can't come up with a way to take that fence out first. Project will love that. And then go to
we didn't modernize it.
What people kind of didn't like was the fact that when those four leads are in, everything stops. So we were trying to come up with a way to have fish pass and still have, a sample moving off into the sample facility at the same time.
Yeah.
Sure, a chance you could have constant, some intermittent four pickets, two pickets
Either that or we just go four or zero.
We've
done that in a couple of years. So we try to do two or three pickets.
This would be better. Tammy's going to come up with a way to satisfy her on this thing, but whether they're in or out, the project's out there and having a look at this stuff, it's their responsibility, and I understand that. But if there's a way to come up with a timer or just a counter that says they're on, they're in, they're down, they're up, the satellite lead to Tammy's cell phone, we will be in good shape.
Have Schwenker look at it as well and see what the hydraulics are. I mean, we never really did look at that with the four across and then the parallel lead. Have Schwenker look at it in detail.
Yeah, let's look at the hydraulics.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if there's really is a difference to draw jacks over or not.
Well, you could test, and if it's hydraulically different, linking that to jacks.
I'm not sure if there's any kind of change. Opinion on that, because I don't think there's that much. Those leads don't cause that much hydraulic head loss. It's typically maybe 2 inches.
And so that was a,
I understand that, but I still see Jeff's percentage, and like you said, that's over 10 weeks. Yeah. That's not one, it's 1 year, but it's also.
It's pretty consistent.
So I can't ignore that. I think there's a bias there. So we do need to do something about that.
Yeah.
I understand that should be done. We'll have to figure out a way, the project's needs are also there and that can be satisfied. So we'll have to figure out a way to.
And if,
a logger of some sort.
To the extent we can, we also, for definitely for the Chinook. We want to see representative sampling throughout the run because we've got a whole bunch of different stocks with different age classes that are, you know, if we miss time, we get a lot of different run times all mixed together. So we've got to have representative sampling every week. And as a general rule, the Chinook, the weekly sampling for Chinook, we could be handling, catching more fish to get those sample rates up a bit. To get up around that 95% confidence interval, you know, you're looking at 400 fish a week. And that's the kind of, you know, typically discussed statistical limits that people deal with.
They are.
And,
do we have any idea where we're at now?
Henry didn't do that part of it. But, you know, he could go through
this to know what our gap is.
Yeah.
So how often are you guys in there a week now? Once a week? Twice a week?
5 days a week.
During lower temperature periods.
Yeah,
for spring.
For 70-72.
Let me ask another question. So if the leads were down the whole time, not that I'm going there, how many days would it take you to get your sample?
It's also probably not just the leads were down, it's the hour. It's a combination of the leads being down and the hours you're there.
If we were only doing Chinook under current rules for 6 hours a day, you might be able to do fish a day.
So there's a cap on how long the pickets are in now?
There's really a cap on in terms of our existing efforts, in terms of how many
sampling you'd want it to be over more time anyway. If you want a most representative sample, you don't want to
Well, that's a whole other issue is that
that's part of why we switched to the 5 days a week.
Yeah. And
because we used to do it in 2 to maybe 3 days.
Yeah.
We used to do it, typically 2, and every now and again would be 3. Then we switched to 5 to try and spread that out and be more representative for the week.
And then,
we're out kind of looking at some of these sample sizes. It's really logistically, it starts to get to be a lot more hours and maybe more pit tags. We wouldn't have any fish, actually. Pit tags, fewer.
So,
we know just from having past conversations that other people, representatives from U.S. states and agencies, don't feel like that might be very nice to do to the fish. Anyhow, just how do we get it? It's kind of within our own agency discussion so that we get some kind of unified voice. I'd say, talk to your SRWG folks and all that and see what, talk to them. And those guys are not saying the same thing as you at our meetings either.
That's, I'm the only management person here, I guess.
So, that's part of our problem and our dilemma is we're getting different stories too.
Yeah.
From
stories
the reps from you guys groups at our meetings. So we decide how we're running this facility.
It's come from the denial.
That would be useful because then at least we'd get a more common voice.
Yeah. So
that 450 is that kind of a weekly? Yeah, weekly.
Yeah, those were weekly sample. Right? That's what Andrew's
talking about. I was just wondering if you'd like bi-weekly.
Yeah.
450 is a lot.
Yeah. And it and
the old scales.
So then for steelhead, that admittedly. We'd like to see a lot bigger sample of steelhead to, and it's like we really, we'll have more A steelhead data than we know what to do with, but it's the B steelhead that we're trying to get some certainty about the B run size. And
the ratio.
And you've got to, in the fact that these B steelhead have this weird runtime relative to the A's, where the A's are peaking at the same time the B's are just barely showing up, and then they're together, and then both kind of high number. Well, the A's are coming down, but they're you end up with some weeks in late September and early October. Sometimes it's a 50-50 split between A and B fish.
Right.
But it's usually when the temperature's about 70
70 degrees or so. And
yeah,
so
that's when the A's are in. That's usually almost always the last 2 weeks of August. Yeah. And then things begin to drop after September.
And August starts to drop down. Stuart, for part of the year, could we possibly, could you possibly operate the trap, just throwing this out, possibly operate the trap, have an operator, say, we're looking at, that's an A, that's a B, let them go by. That one's close, we'll measure it. Do something like that to reduce the number of A's impact, or for part of the run, or
yeah,
part, part of the time?
I mean, maybe, yeah.
And
there
do something
were,
else for kind of an
wager.
H, kind of, or that's a B, or just have you kind of separately sample, keep track of
but
the number of A's and B's, and then preferentially sample the B's or the two closest?
That might help out a little bit,
try
but,
to reduce
but
the
what Gary's going to tell you is that you still got the leads in.
Yeah, you still do.
And
I
you're still delaying
I'm just thinking
what's in there.
We're going to scale sample. And
potentially. Yeah, so
we don't have to scale sample.
Well, we don't
because besides the fact you go through a lot more fish that way in a hurry, you could go out with it, but you wouldn't spend all your time sampling fish. You could. Yeah.
You don't need to.
You know, I'm just offering that out as
take a picture
of these fish scales, too. But I would say, it's interesting what the
portion of these... Take a picture of 700 fish.
But you're looking at fish that are on the edge of one or the other.
Yeah, yeah. The ones that are on the edge, you measure. The ones that are obviously too small, you just send by. I'm just looking at a way to operate a trap without handling all
these. Know the length between the camera and the...
Well, I'm just... Well, yeah.
Maybe under the camera.
It's
just
where we don't...
That might be easy.
The cutoff we had before the 4 point.
That cutoff was done long before we got right.
Maybe we can make a laser measuring board. They got to swim through this laser beam that's 78 centimeters long.
The problem is being real precise in the video. That 78 centimeters, you really need a better feel for.
Nobody's saying this.
No, I'm not measuring. I'm measuring real time, making sure that
I just put it.
I'm going through a water column.
I'm going through one at a time.
They only listed one
singular. You got to train them.
ESU or TV. Now because you couldn't.
Well, you pick up a net and you make them run through.
Maybe somebody will come up with a tool to measure something, but all the value on
Did you submit that proposal? Was there an opportunity? Last year it was too late.
I got it up. My agency didn't send it in, and I didn't submit this year. But it's there, so I'll forward it out, and then Gary wants to move in that direction.
Try and get a mixed stock sample there on a building, and two, you have to have a good representative samples so from the whole population.
Yeah. That's where the management issue gets weird. Right. You gotta work harder to measure something that's an accuracy.
Yes, thanks, Dan. Good
seeing you. Oh, I can see you too. Yeah, so you should come down to Bonneville. Can we give you a tour?
Yeah, why? Well, yeah, maybe
to give you
maybe
a tour.
In the spring I'll come to Bonneville and get a tour.
If you can, if you're in June or July, you should come and see when there's new steel.
Yeah. Or next fall. When the steel has their corrosive retreat. That's really what I'm interested in, steel.
So another thing with the temperature that seems wherever we set the cutoff to change sampling regimes, it really seems more logical to have the same rules on the way up as the way down. Whether we're going to deal in like average temperatures or some sort of instantaneous measurement or something.
It's
dropped out.
The problem is part of it's the way it's monitored and the way the timing of it. There is some logic to the idea that it's
Chairman
now saying it's time to get it going.
I wouldn't mind having a date, say August 15th or something, or August 20th or something. If it trips below before that, then it's got to go 69.5 or something like that. It's that last week or so of August that is where we lose all the false Chinook.
Okay,
well,
there's
the problem.
It's for the
temperatures.
We see with the.
Let's go in there. Never ending. You can't do anything about it.
No.
It's just you just kind of have to accept the fact that there's going to be probably periods of time when you can't see it. Unfortunately, but
exactly.
Unless you go some alternative ways.
We have Pico and Steelhead is getting shut down because of temperature, and when we get shut down, which usually it's only for a week, but it's critical. It's during the critical passage period of these group Bs that we struggle with anyway, and so I think that there's something we can do before or after we know we're getting to that point, or have minimal sampling allowed during the week that we are reaching those higher temperatures or at those higher temperatures, or having some type of consistency with up or down. But
it's a communication issue here. I mean, the deal is that fish managers like myself, we spend our lives trying to save fish. We're just working so hard to save every conservative fish. Very conservative. I'm not saying that. All I'm saying is that
specific focus.
We get so focused on trying to minimize potential take or any effect that, you know, we get groups who come, it doesn't matter who it is, comes in and says, well, we want to do this. And we say, geez, that's a bad thing to do. Well, we want to do it anyway. And it's really a noble cause. Believe us, we're going to do it. And we're saying, yeah, but, you know, everything fiber says don't do that. Don't handle those fish at that temperature. Don't handle those fish at all if you can help it. And the other side says, but we have to. We have to, or we can't save it.
We've got to look a little bit at the larger picture of this, that if the result of being real conservative at Bonneville on the sampling is these potentially large errors in our run size estimation, which lead to the risk of significant over-harvest, then we've gone out and killed way more fish than if they had trapped every fish, you know, 24/7.
So we could have an accurate estimate.
Well, yeah. We don't see that where I said.
I guess.
That's not what I meant. I don't manage harvest. I don't have anything to do with it. I don't even fish. So what I am doing is trying to make sure fish get through Bonneville Dam. And, you know, that's what we're not doing. We're not helping fish get through Bonneville Dam. So, and that's what a lot of other people are seeing. It isn't just myself. They're not at the tables, and I'm representing them. So you're going to get the pushback. The only way to get over that pushback is to have all the information laid out that shows exactly the roadmap that, you know, one, that the data are leading to improved harvest, here's how, and also leading towards improved handling or less handling in the future. Because what you're asking for here, one, I don't have a problem with going down the road of improving the sample from, you know, pulling that fence out and getting a better representative sample or doing that. But then the next step is, well, we want more fish. We want more steelhead, we want more Chinook, we want to sample longer, we want to sample warmer temperatures. That's where people are going to push back. Because we're all focused on, you know, us, or from the management side, are focused on just those fish at Bonneville Dam, saving those fish, getting them through that dam, and on up in order. That's what we're thinking.
But I think that's what we're all thinking about. So that's where I'm having such a hard time on you saying that you're a different fish manager than the
Yes.
Well, you guys are asking me to take a risk.
I mean, you can consider, you ask this guy.
And you're saying, believe me, it's going to be okay. We're going to do better.
So that's your difference.
That's your difference. And I, you know, I'm having trouble with that. I need to see that. And now you can go to my supervisor, and he's going to say the same thing. So you have to go over him. And maybe, you know. So there's lots of layers there. I've been doing this for 25 years. So. I understand. I'm just trying to. I'm trying to argue
stuff we are trying to get accomplished.
I'm just trying to explain it.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to do is work with you guys. What I'm trying to say is that if we have the needs spelled out and the direction, the roadmap to, number one, how we're using these data for better harvest than it is really important, and two, that we're going to use these data to improve the way that we handle fish, and eventually maybe get away from some of the things that we're doing. I think that, people can get on board with that. It begins to make more sense, the amount of fish that we're handling. And it's easier for people to, from my perspective, to say, okay, I see the benefit here. But, you know, usually what we get is John coming down and saying, we need more fish.
I try to explain
how
it's
important.
And we need
even more fish. I know, but it's
just me talking instead of...
Well, I think I'm still saying that some of this needs to be spelled out on a piece of paper.
Right.
You know, I mean, these meetings are great, but we really still need that documentation.
Okay. Can Alan say something here?
Can I say something?
Yeah.
Alan's been trying to chime in here.
For Steelhead, there are some, getting back, this will meet your needs and your needs.
Needs, really, Mr. Idaho.
Yeah, I know, and I'll say it once again. We have all our hatchery steelhead stocks are pit tagged at very large numbers. Starting next year, the two ocean component, which are the B-run fish, there are no one ocean fish, no matter what hatchery they're from, that are going to beat the 78-centimeter cutoff. One ocean steelhead just don't get that big, period. We got 25, 30 years of data that support that. So it's the two ocean fish that come back that are going to be the ones that are going to be candidates for the 78 centimeters. Some of those are going to be over, and some of them are going to be under. Now, since we have those fish representatively pit tagged, you're going to be able to, with your pit tag detection, start telling when those fish are coming over the dam.
They're hatchery fish.
Let me finish. They're hatchery fish. The hatchery fish and the B-run component make over 75 to 80 to 90% of the total B-run. The B-run estimate is dominated by hatchery fish. The wild B-run fish are around 7 days earlier. We have pit tags on some of them, but not a lot, but we still get some pit adult detections from some of our, quote, streams that would be classified B-run. So what I'm saying is, for hatchery stocks, you'll be able to tell when they're starting to show up at Bonneville based on pit tags, which can help you with your sampling. Now, a statistical property of proportions is you don't need to sample a lot of fish when your proportions are very skewed, which they are early in the run, early August, mid-August, when your temperatures are high. You don't need to sample 500 fish to tell you only got 5% hatchery bees. You probably could sample 50, as long as it's random. You need your largest sample sizes when you're at 50-50. That's a property of a binomial distribution. The 50-50 occurs in early mid-September, when usually the temperatures are not the problem. So you can use your pit tag data to tell you when B runs are starting to show up. And if the temperatures are too high, since it's early in the run, you can be pretty confident that you're not at 50-50. You're probably more at 10% or less. And you can go in and maybe sample 50 to 100 fish and meet the 95% confidence interval for a proportion. Then when you get later in the year, you'll start getting more detections from B-run fish, and the temperature issues, hopefully, in most years, won't be the limiting factor, and you can up your sample rates. That's an example of how you can use pit tag data to help you determine some sample size issues when water temperatures are high. And yes, you may not really want to handle fish because you're above your certain threshold, but this data is important, like Stuart said, for a lot of other reasons. And maybe you sacrifice three or four adults at Bonneville rather than 1,500 in gill nets.
Or overestimated by 20,000.
Yeah. Which means that you catch them.
We need this to be written up. And
right.
I think this is a great example.
But that's a protocol that we can do, because the beauty of pit tags is it's real time. And I won't be able to tell you what the proportion that came over that day for the total run, but I can tell you, hey, we're starting to see some fish from Dworshak showing up. So we should be starting to be on the lookout from bees. Not only can I tell you that they're starting to show up, I can tell you some of these two ocean fish are showing. Those are the ones that are key. The one ocean fish we don't have to worry about because they're not going to meet 78 centimeters. But when we start seeing some two ocean adults from Clearwater Hatchery and Dworshak Hatchery, we better start sampling.
So those are based on what? Okay.
And that won't. And we have some wild stocks that are pit tagged. The sample size isn't as large, but we got some indicator streams that we get anywhere from 15 to a good year like last year, 60 or 70 adult detections. And again, can't tell you how many, but we can say, okay, when we start seeing some detections in August from these streams, those are our B stock streams. So that can help formulate a sampling design if water temperatures are an issue or handling concerns are an issue.
Great. So let's kind of wrap it up. Once again, I'm just going to review here. I've heard some good ideas about the potential of using video, some kind of new softwares out there, technology available.
Well, we should look into
that. We need to look into possibility. Pit tagging for the age composition, like you were just talking about, is a possibility. I'd like to hear more about the parental genotyping.
Parental-based tagging.
Parental-based tagging, it's called?
Mm-hmm. Parental-based tagging, yeah.
So these are some options to get away from, reduce some handling. Now, that pit tag analysis that you guys were talking about, where you have some pit tagged at the facility, some pit tagged in river, and then some not pit tagged, is that an analysis that you guys can look at?
I've been looking at it.
Or do you have something available?
Yeah, this is the thing I've got that's best developed. The rest of it is still putting together numbers and
trying
to sort it all out.
As you sort that out, you know, I'd like to have that brought to the table as well.
Now I mentioned something about for Spring Chinook having a database in progress that might help with aging the hatchery component. Was that?
Yeah.
I'm talking about two different sets of.
No, we're talking about the.
Is that the one you were meant, or were you talking about the stuff inside the trap?
Inside the trap.
Okay.
Yeah, it was one of the earlier conversations about looking at the. Pit tag fish at the facility, through the facility, and those that passed.
Yeah, still a lot more facility. To do. Process some data.
Try to get some kind of idea on the mortality.
Still waiting for some data from the guy who's been pulling that out.
So as far as getting some write-ups, some commitments to move forward here, I'm hearing that, Stuart, you guys are...
I suppose Pat can... write and some sort of memos outlining some of these ideas and stuff.
I can provide some pit analysis of runtime and a pit tag. Yeah. We won't have very large sample size, but we do have, mostly be based on wild fish. But we do have some hatchery. We do have some hatchery data. The problem is it's been very small sample size, so we've got to lump it. Years together to get a decent sample size, but that's all we have right
next year.
Starting next year is, like I said, from next year on, we'll have the full complement of age classes. We'll actually
look at the aging proportions for the spring Chinook runs too,
based on notes.
That's a byproduct of what I've been trying to.
So, as we wrap it up, though, I am kind of curious, even though it's not my direct responsibility. So what are we going to do to meet the sample rates for the Accord project? Because, I mean, it does seem, I mean, it's a lot of money to spend on these projects. If we're, do we go back to the federal parties and say, no, we're not going to do these core projects?
And we have to kick it back, though. I mean, it bothers me that people are saying or are dictating that X amount of sampling occurs at these projects.
Well, but that was they went through and designed these projects, and they went through ISRP review, and BPA scoured through them with a fine-tooth comb, and those were agreed to sampling things. I mean, they're written down in that stupid Pisces program that thou shalt do these.
It's a work element.
They're deliverable.
It's a work element.
It's right here.
And you got to check off the stupid box every 6 months,
probably the 95% confidence.
So they're not specific to samples that they're.
But they're specific to those projects that are all set up and funded, and there's contracts written for them. And so, if something has come up now that we can't do those Accord projects,
Nothing's changed. I mean, what the Fish Passage Plan has in it is what it has in it. That was the case when those were written up a year ago.
But the But the,
what's
but the contract dictates...
Somebody didn't look at it. Somebody didn't read the plan. Somebody didn't look at the limitations on sampling.
We read the plan and we provided comments, but I don't know what happened to them.
But somebody didn't. It could be my own agency. I'm not saying it's not. It's just...
No, because I think
left hand, right.
Because of the previous year, I sent it to Lors and to Tammy at the same time. The changes we asked for didn't get added. So
you should be bringing this up.
So the Accord thing seems like it's a huge deal. If we're going to go into 2010 and we're not going to be able to fulfill the contracts on these Accord projects, somebody has to tell the federal parties that look, you know, we made this agreement for all this stuff, and these Accord projects aren't going to happen. They will happen, and they will produce results that will be statistically meaningless.
That's what I mean.
I think that's a policy
thing
on the people that agreed to spend all this money on this
right.
Accord thing.
That is a policy thing.
So they get back,
I'm going to have to have
their court decisions.
Our other researchers are subjected to the same protocols, and they don't always get all their fish, and we still pay them. And they still produce their results.
No, it's not. Then you have a problem.
Well, it's an Accord.
But at least we have a better facility.
But it's no different than any other researcher.
No, it's not.
The temperature reality problem is going to be a big place of conflict. I see forgetting that pursuit.
I always thought that would be the big one. Now, my point is it's getting to do with something like that 70.5. And if we can put it in some sort of a calendar sort of thing, we're fine with me.
We need to have some understanding that the sampling is going to be done, so we get rid of this bias issue, and we get some ideas. I'm working on some stuff with Steelhead, and we want to make sure we're sampling throughout the spring and summer, enough run to get the decent sample sizes for scales, and we'll continue to work on coming up with ways to do better and more clever things in the future, but the MOA thing seems like if the projects are designed that they require a sample size, if you need to take genetic samples off of some certain number of fish to do the study design, and that's already gone through ISRP and everybody, and that's all been agreed to. Backing that up a year is, to come up with some new, to rewrite the proposal and we've got staff hired already, and that's a huge...
The fact of the matter is that there are limitations on the sampling we have on those. Those have changed. So, they were what they were when those were written. So whatever was written needed to consider that. And if whoever wrote it didn't like that limitation, then the money should have been put in.
I would sell a lot more of the MOA money should have gone to give me a raise. That didn't happen at all. Nobody listened to you.
Compared to all the
ground right now, it doesn't seem
But that does seem like that needs to be... That's an issue that I think is probably more of a policy issue.
So we'll have those discussions.
I just turned into a politician.
So you're talking to
I don't know anybody.
our group would be the review to all these things. Just
I'm not aware of these Accord MOA projects.
Those are BPA.
I know, but I know.
I'll find out. Maybe somebody did.
But BPA can't dictate who can access our project either. So there's a chance it's denied.
There's a zillion Accord projects all over the place.
How often have we seen?
Flying around and right
Yeah,
we read all of them because they paid for
them. Well, yeah, I was saying.
What about the idea of modification of aircraft? I guess I keep it to the thinking that we've got some money in the MOA. I wouldn't mind putting in to do better pit tag detection in the trap, but try to get a better idea of what's happening, how long these fish are in this recovering, how long they spend recovering. But I don't want to. I've got money I probably could use this year. I've got a quote from BioBar for doing it, but I don't want to put money into something that's going to be torn out in another year. So it'd be nice to have some.
There's ways around this box, but
yeah, well, it's time for us to start looking at those ways.
We're pushing some new technology.
It would be some money, but then again, we don't want to invest a lot of time.
Well, I
think there would be a larger
criminal forensics.
Right.
If they had a database, every one of our parents, they could tell us who our parents are. You can just do it. The beauty of that, unlike put a white tag.
When you think about how much there are,
it costs $50,000 to get a coat of wire tag. Think how much.
It's not like that there's some wide consensus in the basin that we're not going to trap adult
fish. Lower over time. But we have some proposals. Because we've been collecting samples from all our hatchery fish for the last couple of years. We just haven't been
trapped. People tend to flock into it.
So we want to run those analyses. Regardless of what they're doing, year or two
all kinds of new ideas. But I'm not sure that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, that just gets you a better value for the money that's spent.
Especially for steelhead. The problem with steelhead we have is that we can't count steelhead in the spring on the spawning area just because of the conditions. Maybe once in a while, if you have a drought year, you can catch it. We're doing now is we're going to start sampling representative samples of steel that we have there at Granite and then use we might not get it down to the population scale, but we'll probably get it down to the MPG and the reporting unit. So we'll be able to take those numbers, say 50,000 in France, and then say, okay, I'm at 50,000, 10,000 went from 15,000 to the clear water, or 20,000 went to the cellway, 15,000 went to the lock saw. So it's going to be a lot better than what we have right now.
Yeah.
We're starting that. Those are our two big genetic proposals.
All these,
that we want. We actually want to make this kind of a year, a yearly monitoring. And we're going to put samples of granite. There's some other, you know.
Well, and where there are no fisheries at all, there's still need to count.
Exactly. Yeah.
Sometimes you can do a sawmill also. Of course, you know, the further downriver you go, the more grooves you have, so it makes it a little. Maybe your accuracy diminishes unless they're highly differentiated.
We're trying to recover these wild populations.
Yeah, the differentiated populations. That's one thing we have in Iowa that's kind of. Maybe we have, again, a little bit. In the 80s, you know, a lot of hatcheries that we have in the upper Columbia,
I don't think anyone's coming in after us.
Hope not. No one's coming in. Meeting at 4 o'clock. That'd be awful.
We've got a conference call. 10 minutes.
Which, admittedly, I think people have a